got a lot of golden treasure. How could he know this new dawn's light would change his life forever? How can I be lost if I've got nowhere to go? Search for seas of gold.
WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julene.
Well, thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. Hey, Julene.
Hello, Peter, otherwise known as my driver.
Oh, yeah, yeah, big snow here, even though, without a doubt, 2012 was the hottest ever in the United States. We still get some snow.
Well, it's going to happen. We've got winter.
About three.
Bit of a wintry mix.
Indeed. Hey, welcome to the Night Call Show. I'm Peter Werby, Julene Jordan here with me, or I should say she's Julene Jordan and I'm here with her, however you, yeah. Goes both ways.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you'd like to call us, because this is a phone-in talk show, if you're just joining us for, like, for the first time, just tune by.
Then you're way late to the party.
Yeah. So it's been on for a while. And not tonight, but over the decades of WRIF radio history. But it's one of those shows where I say, hi, you're on the air. So what happens? Jalene and I give our opinions. And then you call 313-298-WRIF or?
313-298-9743. We do have a couple of opinions.
Which actually is the same number. That's the numerical expression. We also take your emails at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And we have, I haven't even looked at Facebook today. But thank you, Jalene. Thank you, Debbie, who does a lot of work on it from far away. Facebook.com/nightcall. And Calvin is in for John. Thank you, Calvin, for coming in.
Very much, especially with this weather.
yeah, indeed.
And late notice.
Late notice as well.
We appreciate that. Yeah. That's why this guy's doing well in the radio business, Calvin.
Well, our pal Paz, rocking the blues over the other station, his producer is out with the flu, and John.
It's hitting hard.
It's going around, as they say.
Yeah.
Well, we made a mistake last week. I said, as I usually do, that the podcast would be available at noon on Monday, forgetting completely, even though we were talking about it all night, that it was Martin Luther King Day.
Mm-hmm.
And so no one was in here, so we didn't have it up until Tuesday.
Yes, so yeah. We apologize. But you can always go to whiterosesociety.org because Ben Birch puts those up the next day.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah. Been doing it for years and years and years. Or you go to WRIF.com and get the podcast. Or you go to my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. Man, we could just keep reeling out the exhausting the information here. The big story, of course, was that, as it says here, and I know these right-wingers love to say the president's middle name, Barack Hussein Obama, opened his second term on Monday. He gave a very assertive inaugural address, thank you, and as it was described in the New York Times, as a robust articulation of modern liberalism in America, arguing, and here's the key word in here, preserving our individual freedoms ultimately requires collective action. Now, the righties hate that because they think, I've done it all on my own. I built this. Remember they were doing that on their stupid convention?
Yes.
But it was very interesting. It was on the day dedicated to the tributes to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. And it's... It, it, this forceful vision, as it says here, of advancing gay rights, showing more tolerance towards illegal immigrants, preserving the social welfare safety net, and acting to stop climate change. In fact, it was an incredible speech.
Yeah, I watched it.
Very, very incredible. On the other hand, I don't think Barack Obama lives up to it. In fact, I would say that if you had to, you know, score him on 1 to 100 on everything that he mentioned, he'd be lucky to get a 40. But a lot of that, so what?
The fact that he's talking about it is big.
Well, that is very big that he's talking about it because it sets the social and cultural context in which political change can occur.
And maybe I think he truly does mean it, but
I think he
knows that a lot of these things are going to be tough to get done because of congressional Republican members.
He's an imperial president of the American Empire, no less so than the men before him. Some were completely awful. Others were better than others. Some changed history. Some caused the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people by their lies. And it's tough for anybody in there to act outside of that context. And
sure.
I mean, if you think about Abraham Lincoln, when he came in, he said that he would not abolish slavery. He had no constitutional capacity to do it.
Slavery, not that he didn't want to.
Slavery was embedded in the Constitution, yeah. So Barack Obama...
Look what happened!
Yeah, Barack Obama used Abraham Lincoln's Bible, as he did 4 years ago. But
and
this
Martin
time,
Luther King Jr.'s.
Yeah, he added that. He became the first president ever to mention the word gay in an inaugural address.
And he referenced the Stonewall situation, yeah.
He equated the drive for same-sex marriage to the quest for racial and gender equality. Now, where would he get that weird idea? What wasn't there a phrase, something like, all men are created equal?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Equal protection under the law, the 14th Amendment and all that. He said these can, well, you know what? Actually, let me see. I think I have it better. Yeah, here. This is from Mother Jones. If you want some good reading on it, I think it's either monthly or every 2 months it comes out. Mother Jones. Mother Jones was a militant labor organizer 100 and so years ago.
Yeah.
But anyways, in Mother Jones, it says, the policy matters he referenced composed a progressive agenda, protecting Medicaid and Medicare and Social Security.
You mean the elderly and
the poor?
The poor?
And yeah.
Women and children?
Yeah. This is the safety net. This affects your grandma and your parents.
I mean, that just it should
you.
Be as it
yeah,
is.
Right. The Republicans, of course, would like to destroy it. I don't think the government has any business doing that. He addressing climate change by developing sustainable energy sources, ensuring equal pay for women, promoting marriage equality, ending the wars he inherited. He said, enduring security and lasting peace do not require perpetual war. And this is like 1984 under Bush, right? Also, he talked about securing immigration reform, opposing restrictive voting identification programs.
Yeah.
Which the Republicans were
preventing
using
people
for vote
from
suppression,
voting, yeah.
And building infrastructure. And though the speech was certainly written for a wide audience, it targeted Obama's people. He paid homage to Seneca Falls. This is where the foundation of women's rights and voting. Selma, civil rights, Selma, Alabama, back in 1965, was it? And Stonewall, a gay riot in 1969, maybe? Something like that. Here's what he said. For our journey is not complete until our wives, our mothers, and daughters can earn a living equal to their efforts.
Oh, the women went crazy on that one.
Our journey is not complete until our gay brothers and sisters are treated like anyone else under the law. For if we are truly created equal, then surely the love we commit to one another must be equal as well.
Mm-hmm. I was happy that he was...
Our journey is not complete until no citizen is forced to wait for hours to exercise the right to vote, which is another Republican strategy.
He pushed
to suppress
the fold
the vote. Yeah.
A little bit. For a president.
Our journey, says President Obama, is not complete until we find a better way to welcome the striving, hopeful immigrants who still see America as the land of opportunity. And that, I mean, the Republicans are getting on board with that simply because they want to get the Latino vote, sure. Until bright young students and engineers are enlisted in our workforce rather than expelled from our country. And he even gave a shout-out to Detroit. President
he did.
Obama, our journey is not complete until all our children, from the streets of Detroit to the hills of Appalachia, to the quiet lanes of Newtown, know that they are cared for and cherished and always safe from harm. Now, as I said, that President Obama, in my book, does not score well of meeting up to that vision. And remember, he said a lot about we And we don't do much. We put our faith, if you will, our hope in politicians, left-wing ones, centrist, right-wing ones, and we hope that they're going to do the right thing for us. But it's really up to the people, and I think that that's a subtext in a lot of what Obama says. If, you know, I'm just going to keep on with, you know, pipelines and nuclear power and oil and gas and all that, unless I see some real action out there for alternative energy to get the sun and the wind working. And if not, if it's just the corporate lobbyists, if I have to depend on corporate donations for the Democratic Party and the election of politicians, well, I'm just going to have to do business as usual. But, Jalene, I think you're absolutely right that he set the context, that he gave a speech like hasn't been done perhaps ever, not just filled with platitudes of nationalism and American exceptionalism and all of that. Although I got to say, a lot of it was, you know, this sort of right-wing thing that America was built on God, guns, and guts.
Right.
There was sure a lot of that for the Democrats. I mean, they fell all over each other, giving these salutes to the troops. A lot of God in there and a secular nation, which I thought was inappropriate. But ain't that America?
That's just the way it goes.
Yeah.
Hey, they included a poet. At least they got a little artsy this time.
And where is he from? Is he from Cuba, I think?
Was
His
he?
Parents were from Cuba.
Yeah,
or maybe
okay.
he was born in Cuba. Yeah.
Yeah. And then all the mainstream media or, you know, people, a lot of people want to talk about is that Beyonce lip-synced it. You know, it's like, can we talk about the speech? Can we talk about?
Yeah, well, that happens when they're expecting bad weather. Boy, if she lip-synced, she sure did a good job.
She did.
I was looking at her and I thought, that's the most beautiful woman in the world.
She's gorgeous. She's
Could you
beautiful.
Imagine, though? Well, I don't know if you, no, you don't usually watch The Daily Show, do you?
I appreciate it greatly. I just don't watch a lot of.
They were showing. They said with Barack Obama, you got, and they showed James Taylor and
Kelly
Beyonce
Clarkson.
And Kelly Clarkson and all that. And they said if Romney would have won, and they showed Meatball or no, what that's not his name.
Meatloaf.
I did that purposely.
Oh, Peter.
I know who Meatloaf is. They showed him singing God Bless America. Did you ever see that clip?
No.
Oh my God, I'm sorry.
Was it horrible?
He was trying to, like, get down, so he is just going, you know, and he's, like, bent over. And Romney is looking like, I can't believe I'm stuck on the same stage with this meatloaf.
Oh, God.
Oh, you got to.
It would have been the Mormon Tabernacle Choir.
Yeah, exactly, instead of the Brooklyn, what was it?
Army Band was.
Well, no, they also had where.
In the parade.
Yeah.
I mean, there were some. They got down, those bands, those marching bands. They were amazing.
But listen, they played, this Brooklyn choir sang Battle Hymn of the Republic from the, you know, from the Civil War. And to me, that was saying like, hey, South, eat it. You know?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, because that was the hymn that the Union soldiers sang, you know, as they went into battle. Well, as you can imagine, you know, the righties, even though they got bonked really bad, lost everything, including the House of Representatives vote, right? You know, because the Democratic candidates for the House of Representatives scored like a million and a half more votes than the Republicans, but because the Republican domination of legislatures, they were able to screw around with the districts.
It's all the redistricting.
Yeah, so they wound up with this majority in the House. But still, the Boner, right?
John Boner.
John Boner.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Boner? Come on. With two vowels go, I don't want to go through the whole thing. With two vowels go walking, the first one does the talking. So the Speaker of the House, John Boner, the Boner says he believes the primary goal of President Obama's second term is, quote, to annihilate the Republican Party.
Yeah, so what?
Oh, yeah, you go. You go, Barack. Given what we heard yesterday in the speech about the president's vision for his second term, it's pretty clear to me that he knows he can't do any of that as long as the House is controlled by Republicans, which is true, Boner said in a speech to the Ripon Society. So we're expecting over the next 22 months to be the focus of this administration as they attempt to annihilate the Republican Party. I love it. And let me tell you, I do believe that is their goal, to just shove us into the dustbin of history. Hey, Boner, You're putting your own self there. Yeah.
Yeah, I caught that one.
Right. Another thing that pleased many women was, well, you know, let me get to that. The combat ban for women is being lifted by the Pentagon. I forgot there was a couple other things here.
I was surprised, but when we get back to that, I'll...
Yeah, now here's a name. Tell me if you remember. By the way, if you want to weigh in on any of this, would love to have you on the air. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743. Already some calls coming
in. Some calls coming in. Your reaction to the speech, anything else as well. But now here's a name out of the past. I'll give you a second or two. Tell me if you remember this. Mitt Romney.
Yeah.
Remember him?
I kind of, just vaguely.
Yeah. Well, he's kind of dropped out of sight because he said he didn't want to say something on the fiscal cliff and have the president use that as a wedge between the speaker and the minority leader. What? I don't know what the hell he's talking about. Well, no one, neither did anybody else during the campaign.
But he said he's not going away.
Yeah. He said, we lost, but I'm not going away. I will continue to help. You know what he will help do? He will help, as the boner said, shove us into the dustbin of history.
That's right.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
So usually...
Keep on trucking, Mitt.
Because you said, I think, something like, I don't know, do you usually say, or is this my crude remark about don't let the door hit you in the ass?
Of course I say that.
Okay, you said that you said about...
This is me you're talking to.
You said this is about Romney. I'm saying, you know, come on back. Yeah, man.
All right.
Keep hanging out.
Yeah, in this case, he can stick around.
That's right.
Yeah.
You
know,
that's
do right. all the damage he wants.
Okay. Now, though, so all the liberals and all the progressives, all the lefties, all the radicals, well, not the radicals. But everybody left the center is, you know, kind of going, I don't know if you can, you know.
Yeah, like, wash your hands
of it. Wash your hands. Get, you know, these guys are in the dustbin of history. Well, you know, they haven't ceased one little bit. The millionaires and the billionaires are still there with their money for the gubernatorial races in 2013, for the congressional races in 2014. And they haven't given up one little bit. Now, they realize that their base of older, angry white guys is diminishing considerably.
Yeah.
When they talk now, I mean, like they jettison people like, tell me if you remember this name.
Who?
Sarah Palin.
Oh, yeah. Didn't she kind of perk back up this week?
Yeah, well, she got booted off of Fox News.
What?
You didn't know that?
Wait, what do you mean?
She's no longer an employee.
Oh, no,
of Fox News.
I knew that. I thought you meant this weekend.
No. Yeah. So, and I'm sure the strategy, the Roger Ailes, who runs Fox News, said, we thought that this woman was really going to energize the conservative movement, but instead she was so polarizing and people were so frightened of her as a political figure.
Well,
I mean, I don't know why
they knew that they couldn't take her seriously. People finally figured that out.
Well, I don't know why they didn't figure that out in 2000, after 2008, but another 4 years and really almost getting shoved into the dustbin of history, to use the boner's phrase. They figured they've got to reconfigure themselves. They have to appear much, much more moderate than they are. They'll still have the far right wing, pro-corporate, anti-people politics, mm-hmm. but they want to look different. Although they'll probably be on board with something that will modify the strict enforcement of immigration rules, because they figure they're not going to get African Americans. They probably can't get women. So Latinos.
Except for some women.
Some women. Yeah. Well, sure. I mean, it's not like they get all the...
The robot women.
Okay. It's not like they get all the middle-aged white guys either.
Right.
Not by a long shot, to be sure. So, but if here, and Charles M. Blow, who
writes for the New York Times.
Yeah, who's wonderful. He's got a column, a couple days ago, rig the vote, actually Saturday. If you can't win by playing fair, cheat. That seems to be the plan of Republican lawmakers in several battleground states that stubbornly keep going for Democrats during the presidential elections. Remember, they were crying the blues because they said, boy, if you took away all those people of color, Romney would have won.
I mean, that's just...
They actually said that,
The crap and hate...
Yeah.
And evil words that come out of these people's mouths.
Yeah,
it's unconscionable.
If you took away all the white racists in this country, It would be a wonderful place.
It would be
place
a beautiful place to be.
We could pass all this great legislation. Everybody would be taken care of and have good jobs and great minimum wage and health care for everybody and all of that. But we're stuck with them, you know, as a minority. And so they're mad because they're stuck with us as a majority.
Oh, yeah.
Which is kind of interesting.
Wait, ready? Too bad. We're here.
Thanks in part to gerrymandering. Gerrymandering is where they create districts that are really odd shaped in order to manufacture the political result in terms of who gets elected. So in other words, hopefully you know what it is. We'll go on.
That was a good enough explanation.
Republican lawmakers in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Wisconsin are considering whether to abandon the winner-take-all approach to awarding electoral college votes and replace it with proportional allocation. In other words, when Romney gets skunked in Michigan, then all the electoral college votes go to Obama. What they want to do is they want to change it so it comes out differently. Peter Lund, a Republican state representative in Michigan, quote, plans to reintroduce legislation that would award all but two of Michigan's 16 electoral college votes according to congressional district results. This is from the Detroit News. The paper continued, the remaining two would go to the candidate winning the statewide majority. And Charles Blow says these bills are a brazen attempt to alter electoral outcomes and chip away at the very idea of democracy to the benefit of Republican candidates.
It's amazing the ways they find it.
Here's what would happen. Romney would have gotten 9 of Michigan's electoral votes and Obama would have received 7 in 2012 under Lund's proposal. Instead, Obama garnered all 16 Michigan electoral votes en route to his national tally of 332,000. Obama beat Romney in our state by 450,000 votes, but hey, they don't care about that. Because they never, I mean, think about Bush 1. I mean, or Bush 2, rather, George. Remember him? There's another thing. Remember George W. Bush?
that one, Peter.
I mean, you know.
Guy's tough to forget, okay? The destruction that man caused, I will never forget.
Yes, and the deaths and the debt and everything.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if you say Jimmy Carter, everybody goes, oh, yeah, Jimmy Carter, he's out there doing this and that, you know? And people say Bill Clinton, oh, yeah, you know, he's out there doing that.
Mm-hmm.
George W. Bush, where is he? You know, I mean,
down on the ranch.
Although Obama won the state of Virginia.
Torturing Laura.
And all of its electoral votes last year, as he did in 2008, according to the Roanoke Times on Friday. If the system had been in effect for the 2012 election, Republican Mitt Romney would have won 9 of Virginia's 13 electoral votes, and President Barack Obama would have won 4. Keep in mind, in November, Obama won the state by almost 150,000 votes. So here is the deal. The sponsor of Virginia's bill, Charles W. Carrico Sr., a Republican, said he wants to give smaller communities a bigger voice.
Oh, really?
The last election, constituents were concerned that it didn't matter what they did. The more densely populated areas were going to outvote them. Think about what...
Doesn't that make sense?
Yeah. But also think what densely populated areas is a code word
the
for.
The city? You mean, okay.
And Charles
Urban
Blow,
areas?
Charles Blow says, yes, you read that right. He wants to make the votes cast for the candidate receiving the fewest votes matter more than those cast for the candidate receiving the most.
Ugh.
In Republican bizarro world where the, quote, the integrity of the vote is a phrase used to diminish urban votes and in which democracy is only sacred if the Republicans are winning, this statement actually makes sense. Let's see. Is there anything more? Yeah.
Scary, Peter.
Yeah. He said, also in Virginia, he said, this bill counts an Obama voter as 3/5 of a person.
Human being, see?
Yeah. That is because his talking point memo says Obama voters would have received almost exactly 3/5 of the electoral votes compared to the actual population. And, hey, that's what slaves were counting.
That's right. This makes me shudder.
These people are shameless, and they're not. And
they're shameless and they're sick.
And every one of these millionaires and billionaires that put all this money onto Romney and lost, you know, they haven't batted an eyelash in terms of, still going at it. Like they say, don't you think you're wasting your money? No one, absolutely no one that you backed got any won.
Yeah.
And we're still, because you got to remember, these people have so much incredible money. For instance, the mayor of New York, one of my favorite billionaire to bash, he just gave $350 million to Johns Hopkins University, where he graduated from. He said, you know, they prepared him. Payback, $350 million.
My God.
Yeah. Remember, what am I always saying? Our little town is $3 million. 1% of that is less than 1% of that is what we're, you know, reason we had to lay off cops and firemen.
Well, and make them work 12-hour shifts.
Yeah, exactly.
Cut their pay by 10%.
So I was thinking about that. I think Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, is worth $10 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So, oh, here I go with, so I think.
Here you go with your math again.
$350 million is like less than 5% of his wealth.
Right. So why doesn't he?
Or wait a minute.
No, don't do it, Peter.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. My friend Matthew, although you can text me, Matthew. Do the math, please. Thank you.
All right. $350 million is what percentage of $10 billion, please? All right. We can get your calls at 313-298-WRIF. Here from the city by the bay, here is David calling from San Francisco. David, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, greetings, Peter and Jolene.
Hi.
Hi, David.
You know, a couple of things. I heard you talking about the State of the Union. There was the one comment about Mitt Romney and his legacy. One legacy that we're going to have for a quarter million years is that the fact that that guy helped outsource the nuclear plant parts. There are a lot of switches and all sorts of very pretty indispensable items that go in the nuclear power plants. And because Mitt Romney helped to outsource so many jobs overseas to China, that now the nuclear power plants, there used to be about 1,400 different companies in America that provided parts for these plants. Now it's about cut in half, and now there's a problem with counterfeit parts.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's horrifying.
I mean, it's one thing to have counterfeit, what are those fancy
money
purses?
Money or...
No, money's bad.
Handbags.
What's that famous one? Handbag?
Well, there's... Prada, what? Louis Vuitton.
Yeah. It's okay to get those on Canal Street.
In New York City.
Yeah, for $15.
Right.
But we don't like counterfeit
nuclear parts.
No, that's bad. That's bad. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the one legacy of Romney.
Coach.
But the other one, and it's interesting, I heard you talking about the neocons or the Republicans are trying to recapture the Hispanic vote. And it's interesting because... You're probably aware that the International Monetary Fund had allowed the U.S. dollar, ever since World War II, the U.S. dollar was the major currency of the world because all of the other currencies of the world had to be pegged against the U.S. dollar.
Right.
And it was because America's reputation was seen as one that allowed expansion of education, freedom of speech, entrepreneurship, inventions were predominant, and so much growth was coming out of America that because our society was growing because of education, we were seen as a good bet to base an economy on. And if we were going to have a fiat economy, that was a pretty smart idea. But since Bush basically turned us into a world of paranoia and suspicion and fences, he's ruined our reputation, and nobody wants to invest in America anymore, and so the U.S. dollar is no longer seen as a good bet for pegging all other currencies against it. So for the Republicans, any Republican in their right mind wants to have America's currency as the primary one.
Well, they do, and I think that's why the Boehner led the House Republicans to extend the debt limit. All right, David, thank you very much. Appreciate your calls. David has called this show for a long, long time.
Very cool.
Yeah, very cool. Hey, I forgot, by the way, the sitting Congress, even though the Democrats were, the people of the United States were essentially cheated out of a Democratic majority in the House of Representatives as well, because the majority of people voted for Democratic candidates, but because of the rigging of the districts, the Republicans have the majority. But for in the 113th Congress, there are 6 openly gay or bisexual members in the House. Who says that? I mean, what's your sexual orientation? I'm bisexual. I mean, it's so bizarre.
I'm openly gay.
Yeah.
I know.
A small but tangible.
Why do they care? Why do people care?
But tangible sign that they're present at the presence at the highest level of governments is no longer something only to be whispered about. So I don't know. There's 6 openly gay or bisexual members in the House, and I suspect they're all Democrats, although they're probably greatly outnumbered by the closeted gay Republicans. Without it, no doubt.
No question.
Yeah, the Senate has its first lesbian, so bizarre. Tommy Baldwin of Wisconsin. Tammy Baldwin. The lawmaker's partner is no longer relegated to the shadows or introduced generically as friends. Stood by them on the House floor when they were sworn in this month. And guess who swore them in? The boner himself.
Ah, well.
Yeah, the Speaker of the House. He had to do it.
How about that?
And, of course, you know, they've probably got
under his breath.
They figure, you know, it's another.
His tongue.
You know, at some level, they're up at the upper levels of power. They couldn't. They don't have high degrees of prejudice against anybody. They're just all about power. And if you can add to it, fine. You know, if you can be, do you think that there is any Republican upper echelon guy that cares that there's a black Supreme Court justice or that there,
no.
You know, or that black congressman from South Carolina and I was a Republican? You know, that's not what they're on about. And by the boner standing with these gay Congress people, I mean, if they figure, okay, we can start chipping away at the
prejudice.
Not prejudice.
Homophobia.
At the majority that the Democrats command among gays. If they're not seen as this party of intense hostility towards gays, which they are.
Right.
Right. Okay, we're going to take a break, but I want to put this out to you.
Are we going to talk about the Pentagon?
Yeah. I want to just get people, but. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta is lifting the military's official ban on women in combat, which will open up hundreds of thousands of additional frontline jobs, as they call it, to them. According to senior defense officials, the groundbreaking decision overturns a 1994 Pentagon rule that restricts women from the artillery, armor, infantry, and other such combat roles, even though in reality women have frequently found themselves in combat in Iraq and Afghanistan. According to the Pentagon, hundreds of thousands of women have been deployed in those conflicts, and there's been 800 women wounded in the two wars. More than 130 have died. I wonder how.
Think about how that compares to the men.
Yeah, I wonder how you feel. And you know, there's a lot of vets out there listening. What's your thoughts about that? I mean,
do you think women can handle it? I know for sure I could not.
Well, I'm telling you.
You know, I'm 5'2". I'm about.
But you got eyes of blue.
I got eyes of blue. You know, and that doesn't matter over there, does it?
Oh, I'm telling you.
I weigh about 115 pounds soaking wet. There's no way in hell I could do that.
You weigh 115. Come on.
Well, yeah.
A little more.
Peter, you're in huge trouble. You're going to get slapped during the commercial break.
You're looking good. But someone says, oh, she's a little skinny mini. And why are you blushing?
We know where all my weight is.
Yeah, let's go on. All right, let's talk about that. I mean, I got to tell you, I am 100% for women's rights and equality of pay and all that. But, I go to this gym that I play handball at. There, a lot of guys are in there lifting.
Mm-hmm.
And, what am I, about 5'10 and a half, 170 pounds? Maybe
a little more.
You're right.
Liar.
Yeah. And so these guys are like 6'1", and they weigh like 195. And I mean, that's who I want next
to me. They're machines.
That's who I want next to me. All right, so what do you think? Women in combat, good idea, bad idea? What do you think the consequences are going to be? We'll be right back. Get your calls.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The weekend brought to you by the Club Keno Jackpack from the Michigan Lottery. Now through February 10th, for every 5 draws you buy with the jack, you get 1 draw free. It's jam-packed with fun. The riff.
Clipping coupons. Standing in line at 4 a.m. Buying 5 to get 1 free. Maybe it's me, but I don't think it should be that hard to save money, which is why we made Geico.com so easy. Just a few clicks and you could be saving hundreds of dollars on your car insurance. And when you switch to GEICO, you can do practically everything online. Report a claim, update your policy, even pay your bill. Click Bam Boom. Visit GEICO.com today. Click Bam Boom. I'm rather fond of that one.
Enjoy your beer.
Cool. I didn't always watch football here at Buffalo Wild Wings.
Hey, buddy.
Hey.
Come on in.
Thanks. Is it safe?
Yeah, man. Come on, let's watch the game.
This one's freaking me out.
Nah, he just wants to play. Careful when I bring out the snacks, though. No sudden movements.
But my nose itches.
Protect the football. Watch every game here. Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings. Beer. Sports.
Do you have the time to listen to me whine about nothing and everything all at once? I am one of those melodramatic fools, neurotic to the bone, no doubt about it. Sometimes I give myself the creeps. Sometimes my mind plays tricks on me. It all keeps adding up. I think I'm lucky.
Opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much. Remember, you can always go to our Facebook page. That's easy for you to say. Facebook.com/nightcall. We were talking about the Obama inaugural speech and how important it was in the setting of a social and political and cultural tone.
First, yeah, it was an opening, really.
Yeah, and it's up to us. If it's just left to Obama and the Democrats, very little is going to change. It's up to us.
Speak, yeah. People.
Did you notice that I have not mentioned the G word tonight?
Yes.
Yeah. That's what I meant. I'm going to mention it just to say I'm not going to mention it.
Okay.
Gun.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's all we've been talking about.
Yeah.
Ever since Newtown and before. I mean, but since Newtown... But it's just been tough to avoid, Peter. And we've got a couple people like, please quit talking about guns. Yeah, but well, people aren't stopping talking about guns.
Well, it's
in the last week.
I would almost like to make this a
gun-free show.
Gun talk-free show. Yeah, because I don't know what more we can say. Yeah.
I know.
And I just want to reassure. I want to disappoint all the gun control supporters and usher the anti-gun control people that very little is going to change.
Yeah, I think that's yeah. And we have a couple people on hold. We'll be right to you. We were talking about before the break. Peter.
Greg Palast said the whole issue is a weapon of mass distraction. There are so many important things that we have to talk about.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah. So one of those things that we were talking about before the break that we said we were going to talk about, Pentagon setting to lift the combat ban, lifted the combat ban.
For women.
For women, which I didn't even know this was going on. To me, I felt like it came out of the blue. I was completely shocked when I read this headline.
It seems to me, and some people are starting to pick up the phone and call about this one, 313-298-WRIF, that it really depends. Well, I have a neighbor, a woman, who is probably, I have to stand up as straight as I can every time I'm with her, or, you know, if I start slumping a little, which I tend to
do. You're slumping right now, Werby.
Am I?
A little bit.
Well, I can't. What am I going to do? Sit.
Pull the microphone up.
Yes.
Yes. All right. There you go.
Ooh, now I have a pole up my butt. Yeah. Anyway, so she's probably 5'9", very big, very strong, very, you know, that'd be okay. And then I know of a guy who's like a man who's like 5'2".
Yeah.
And so if it came to combat, I'd rather have her with me so than him. So maybe it's not about whether their gender, but about how physically fit they are and what have you.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
And women are in the main smarter than men because
I'm not going to say anything.
Men and young men and maybe me too tend to suffer from testosterone poisoning. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, someone said if you get women in combat, you probably won't have guys carrying out the atrocities that they do from time to time.
Okay, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah. Do you think women would be pissing on dead bodies of Afghans?
No. Oh, I see what you're saying. They would be like more, hey, you can't do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought you meant like the sexual assaults in the armed services.
Well, there's an incredible amount of sexual assaults going on. I don't know why, I tell you the truth, I don't know why women even join given the level of sexual assault.
No way I would. Yeah. Oh, no.
Winston Smith writes in the call talk, yes, at yahoo.com, I hope you know the ban on women in combat has been lifted because of a shortage of what he calls cannon fodder in Afghanistan, and enlistments have slowed. Apparently, the public is wising up. Mm. If they can't get enough women, I expect they will start recruiting in Tijuana and Juarez, after that, San Quentin and Attica.
Wow.
He's cynical.
Not really.
Wow. Anybody got an answer to that one?
Oh,
313-298-WRIF. Leslie, here is Corey. Corey's in Romeo. Corey, hi. Thanks for joining us. You're on the air. What do you think?
Thank you. Actually, I just got out of Marine Corps boot camp about a week ago.
Wow.
And I heard about the lift about women in combat, and I don't exactly think it's a bad thing. You know, I think it's it opens up a lot of jobs in the military, especially, you know, in the infantry sector, you know, artillery. But at the same time, you know, I have to mention that if you can imagine guys in the field for 6 months and there's one or two females in the unit, you know, I think that might cause, I don't really have to get into it, but it might cause some issues, if you know what I mean.
Well, I think it just,
their we were just kind of saying that I was anyway,
because I forgot. I suddenly dropped the. Oh, here, yeah, there's, let's see, hundreds of thousands of women have been deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan as it is. So they're around. And, you know, I think what you're getting at, Corey, is a great concern to the armed services that there's been a high number of sexual assaults within the armed services. So that just that, I know what you're saying. I mean, you have young men, right? And you have young women. That's always
A combination.
Yeah,
I gotta say, I don't think there would even be a sexual assault. I mean, you know, you got young people out in the field, even if you're not, you know, in a combat, you know, area. The mixing between female and male in the military, especially the Marine Corps, is kind of on a, you know, a basis of, you know, two two private different sectors working together. You know, if you have, let's say, females in intelligence, they might be working with males at the same time in the office, but in the field, it's a different story altogether. There is no mixing of sexes.
Yeah,
when it comes to that.
Yeah, besides just, you know, forgetting the sexual assaults, which are they don't happen all the time, but I suppose sexual liaisons could occur.
Oh, please. Everywhere.
Right. Yeah, let's end all this and
think about,
keep,
you know,
you safe,
when you're
thank
in
you.
That type
appreciate
of
your call.
Situation. Yeah, thank you. A situation like that, Peter, you know, your emotions are different too.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's that factor.
But now gays can serve in the military.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I wonder how sexualized militaries were when they were all male, supposedly all straight.
I have no idea.
Me neither. And I emphasize supposedly. All right, here's Mike in Fenton. Mike, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Wow, sex in the military. What about that?
What about it?
Well, I'm just Leon Panetta. We're going to have women in the military, and I guess that means that the guys ain't coming home. We got a plan that's going to go on forever to keep killing people.
What do you mean?
I mean, we need to bring our guys home.
Yeah.
And these guys are talking about putting women in the military, which tells me that they don't plan on bringing anybody home.
Oh, no. All they're just doing, they're just lifting a ban, you know. I mean, there's always going to be a military. They're just lifting a ban. And there's always going to be war.
Well,
not necessarily. If we could learn how to act.
Yeah, but
well, that's what, you know, Obama in his inaugural address said. We do not have to keep this perpetual warfare going on, which, I mean, if you think about it, how well this works for stirring up these patriotic and nationalistic feelings when the war is going well. Mm-hmm. The only problem that Bush had was that he started these wars
illegally
and that didn't have the capacity for victory. I mean, if you look about particularly what's going on in Iraq now, and Afghanistan has been ruined as well. And
but Peter, those people have been liberated. What are you talking about?
There you go. All right, Mike, thank you very much. Some open lines at 313-298-WRIF. Here is Steve in Ann Arbor. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
How you doing, guys?
We're good.
I wanted to talk on the women in combat topic.
Sure, please.
I am a veteran of the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
I personally feel, if a woman wants to be on the front lines fighting along with, her brothers, there's nothing wrong with it. Women are expected to do the exact same thing as men. They're expected to fire their weapon accurately and precisely, just as any male soldier is. And they're expected to carry the same amount of gear. There's really the only reasons I see a downside would be like the instances you were talking about, the possible sexual assaults due to like a prisoner situation. The enemy could put a lot more torture on our female soldiers than they would, a male.
God, I hadn't thought about that one.
Yeah. But tell me your experience in Iraq. How, there was, as Leon Panetta said, and as we know, there was hundreds of thousands of women at different times in both theaters. So what, when you were there, when did you come in contact with women? Did you every day or once a week or what?
Oh, no, there was women on base constantly. And like you said, there's many instances where the women are at the front lines anyway.
Yeah.
It's in the beginning, it was extremely confusing situations. And, there's many times there, a female soldier would be right next to you firing. As you said, the statistics, I'm not, aware of them, but, some of our female soldiers did, pass or get wounded in hot firefights in the combat.
Yeah,
sure.
In the New York Times, yeah, they said 800 women wounded and 130 had died.
Yeah, which I didn't know. If you would ask me how many, I probably would have thought around zero. So it shows how little that figure is known. But in this modern warfare where we're never involved any longer in, traditional confrontational battle line wars, I think you could probably count the number of prisoners of war, U.S. prisoners of war on one hand, right, in the last 12 years. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean,
yes.
there's no, you know, it's not like, I forgot during the Civil War. I was just reading the book, and I can't remember now, but there were prison camps with on both sides, the South and North. One camp would have 15,000, Southerners and 10,000 Southerners at another one. So you had tens of thousands of prisoners, but in these wars were, usually fighting irregular. Steve, thank you very much. Appreciate your call.
That's your puppy for us. His dog was barking in the background.
He was?
Yeah.
Oh, he was just clearing his throat.
No. It's okay. I'll be your ears, Peter.
Here's Doug in St. Clair Shores. Doug, hi, you're on the air. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good.
Desert Storm Veteran Field Artillery.
Okay.
We had women in my unit. They were mechanics.
Uh-huh.
And they fought, they were right with us, but, they couldn't pick up the shells. They were too heavy but they were right along with us on the front lines, and they served with distinction. And honor and everything else. And it's if a woman can do that, then I think any woman can, if they're able to do the job, I don't have any problem with that.
I guess that's what it comes down to, is that it doesn't matter your gender. It matters your capacity to actually, as we've been calling it, to carry out the job. And some men can't, and some women can, and some women can't, and some women can, probably, eh?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I saw that, firsthand. And I just don't see where the problem is here. As long as they're physically able to do it, do the job, I have no problem with it whatsoever.
What do you think about I was being, only half serious, saying women are smarter than us guys? You think?
In some ways.
Well, one of the things
I don't know that we need to get into all this.
Yeah,
huh?
One of
that's
the things
another show.
They know. They usually know to keep out of fights.
Come on, women, meow. Have you ever heard of a cat fight?
Yeah, there you go. All right, Doug. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call.
I'm pleasantly surprised, Peter, by
everyone says
by the majority of men who I've heard talk about it have been like, hey, come on, man.
I mean, on the show tonight.
In general. In life, on television, on, just in the media or whatever, Ed, and on end tonight.
Yeah.
So.
Well, again, what that signals is, I hate cliches when we use one, part of the sea change, the cultural sea change that has come about in the last 30 years, that's generally been resisted by the right wing, that wants, because, women in combat is probably going to represent a fairly small slice of the American population. But women who, as the president said in his inaugural talk, still aren't getting equal pay. And that's why all that stuff about equality, that's why the founding fathers said all men, they meant, I think they probably just meant men. But what we mean is all people are created equal. And that means that you can't discriminate on any aspect of social, cultural, political life.
I'm so glad I make so much more money than you, Peter.
Hey, talk to the boss, man. I don't pay your salary. Let's go way down to the cradle of the Confederacy, where the state where it started the Civil War, South Carolina, and pick up Lib. Hey, Lib, how you doing?
Hey, guys.
Hello.
Good, great show.
Thank you,
Peter and Jolene.
Thank you for listening.
I was in Desert Storm.
Okay.
In my 20 years in the Army, I worked for and with women, and for that poor, young Marine.
Yeah.
Wait until you get out there. Man, the women make the military stronger, better, faster, and smarter.
I'm not shocked by this at all.
I just think us men are fairly
dumb. And I'm not
dumb.
Just saying it as a woman. I'm not, you know? I'm not, I'm
really
not.
I'm not trying to pander to women. I've no need to do that. But I think you get a bunch of men together without any women, they do the damn dumbest things. What
absolutely.
What's that, you know, it's like Jackass, those films.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that the name of those films?
Yes, it's the name of those films.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Alan West.
Jackass. Now, remember, I went out to L.A. and went to the premiere with the guys from Jackass. And before I saw those movies, I was like, oh, these are so stupid. But then you meet these guys, and they're really nice.
Well, I mean, you can be dumb and nice.
Yeah, they're really fun. I had a great time with them. But yeah. Anyway, yeah, that's what yeah. happens. That's what happens, right?
If he is still listening, the Marine.
Yeah.
I would highly recommend that he Google, brain fart.
That's the name of the website?
No.
Damn brain fart.
I'll bet you, wait a minute.
I wish, yeah.
Wait, you know what? I'll bet you if you go. Wait.
Okay, I got it.
All right.
Goldie Taylor. She is a commentator on MSNBC.
What is it again?
Goldie Taylor.
Okay. That's an old-fashioned name, Goldie.
Yeah.
Yeah. She lives down in Georgia.
Yeah.
She's often on MSNBC. She is a female Marine.
Really?
And yeah. I tell you, you would not want to cross her on a dark night on the street.
I got you. All right. Well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put in dambrainfart.com, and I'll bet you there is some.
Peter.
I'll bet you a website comes
You're
up.
You're lowering the intelligence of this program.
Yeah, well, I'm a guy. All right. Thank you. Thank you from calling.
That's what I'm
from
here for.
South Carolina. All right.
I'm here to keep it smarter, Peter.
We are going to take a break. Darren, you are next. If you'd like to get your comments in, please call. And but I want to talk more about this. Doesn't seem to be any disagreement. I thought there was going to be some people going to say, no, we can't have women in there.
Well, is there anyone who does disagree? I want to hear.
Yeah.
And I won't be. You can say it in front of me. It's okay.
Yeah. If by the way, this may sound like some. Well, in a way, this is mostly a Detroit issue. But it's our Island Park that's in the middle of the Detroit River. It's called Belle Isle. It's about 1,000 acres. And the city, the mayor at least, has an idea to turn this over to the state to take the cost off the back of Detroit that's pretty
close.
Well,
it's a mess over there.
It's a mess. And so this would, so Belle Isle would become a state park. And a lot of Detroit politicians at least are saying, you know, it's going to be hijacked by the state. And we can talk a little about that. But more with the Pentagon's lifting the combat ban for women, and also criminal corporations. And let me ask if you can guess which party is most represented.
Oh, boy, that's going to take me the whole commercial break.
In the criminal docket. All right. Also, we'll give you an idea of who I'm going to be interviewing at 1 a.m. Right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
If you're like me, you probably had to do something hard today. I mean, personally, I hate washing out socks. That's why we made Geico.com so exceedingly easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to review and update your policy. Change of address. Just a few clicks and you're done. Visit Geico.com today, because life is hard enough. I mean, I don't even wear socks.
Whose house is it? Whose house?
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Oh, yes!
Okay.
The Riff. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
Thank you very much. This is our second hour. You can join us at that phone number. Open lines right now. We're talking about the Barack Obama inaugural speech and what you thought of it. First time a sitting president has, president being inaugurated, has ever mentioned the word gay. Talked about our gay brothers and sisters really created a different vision of America, closer to what we're all about, not that pretty narrow spectrum of what Mitt Romney and the Republicans and the Boehner represent.
Yeah.
At 1 a.m. tonight, I'm going to be interviewing Lawrence Blum. He's written High School's Race and America's Future. And this is a college prof, and he taught in a high school. He taught a course on race and racism in this ethnically, racially, and economically diverse school in Cambridge, Mass. That was pretty interesting. And also, Dale Maharaj, he and a friend had this 30-year project in which friend was a photographer. They followed just regular old people around and chronicled their lives. And you could say, yeah, well, come on, where's the excitement? Well, it's about us. Yeah, it's about ordinary people.
Nice.
We are talking also about the decision of the Defense Department to lift the ban on women in combat.
Mm-hmm.
And but before we, a little thing.
And where did that come from? Did you even know that they were talking about that? Or, I mean,
I don't know if I knew.
It was simply out of nowhere. It was a nice surprise.
You know the Charles Shaw wines that are called Two Buck Chuck?
Yeah, Trader Joe's.
Yeah, but are they? Aren't they? Don't they sell for $3?
Well, that's what I thought.
We call it Three Buck Chuck.
I know. I'm confused by this, but anyway.
Yeah, because they're raising the price in California. Maybe that's where it is. From
in California.
$1.99 to $2.49. And they got this whole big article about it. They had to raise it 50 cents. What's up with that?
Well, you know, it adds up. People drink a lot of Two Buck Chuck.
Now, I think wine is good for you.
I do, too. Yeah. Red wine, specifically.
In moderation, but even white wine has some of those same good
properties.
Old stuff. And it's also a nice convivial drink. Not to to discount beer. When us guys get together in a group, we like to chug down the brews.
Grab your crotches.
And not to... not to diminish spirits. I mean, this is, talk about free advertising.
Valentine Vodka, which is in Ferndale.
Ferndale, yeah.
Here in Michigan, for those who are listening around the country or the world. But this is a local show. So you need to check this place out. It is so cool. They make their own vodka.
And now gin as well.
I didn't know about the gin.
And they're doing whiskey.
Oh, gosh.
Well, boutique liquors are really happening all over the country.
Yeah, and craft beers, things like that. Yeah. And so, yeah, I've been to Valentine Vodka. You were there.
I was just there with my wife and a neighbor. And my wife doesn't. Did I tell you this story? My wife doesn't drink at all.
Yeah.
So I had a gin gimlet.
Isn't that weird? Why are we involved with people? You've been married for 8 million years.
Yeah.
We're both with people who don't drink.
Your boyfriend doesn't drink?
No.
Oh.
Not anything.
What isn't there a George Thorogood song about something about drink?
I drink
home?
Alone.
No, yeah, but that was.
Oh, that's me.
Something about drink or go home. Anyway,
even when I'm with him, I'm drinking alone.
So our friend is drinking some vodka mixed drink, and I'm drinking a gin gimlet. And gin gimlet is essentially gin and lime juice.
It's an old school drink.
Yeah, and my wife is drinking Faygo Rock and Rye. Right?
Which is fabulous.
Yeah, it was fabulous. And it's a real old school. And so my wife says, can I have a sip of that?
She's thinking, oh, it's nice and limey and tart.
So there's a straw in the glass, which I wasn't using, you know, the cocktail. And she takes this monstrous sip of it and starts going, this tastes like gasoline. The whole place.
Could hear her?
Yeah.
That's not surprising to me right there.
No.
But the owner of Valentine Vodka listens to this show.
Yeah, and in case you're listening, I would dispute her description of your gin. I thought it was wonderful.
Well, she doesn't drink alcohol.
No,
that's the problem.
And
She took too big of a drink. She needs to stay away from it and just never even try it.
She's got along this long without it. Yeah. But here, so that stuff is good. I love it. But what I don't love, although you do, is soft drinks, right? Remember we last week someone wrote in and said they wanted to cure you of your addiction to soda?
I got a 2-liter this week of Royal Crown Cola. Do you remember that?
Yeah, wow, that's
RC Cola.
Wow.
Yeah. Sorry, people who are trying to get me to drink soda, but this is funny.
PepsiCo.
You know what RC Cola is? It's kind of old school itself,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
My boyfriend looked at my fridge and he goes, "RC Cola, what is that?"
And really?
You know what? He's quite a bit younger than me.
Well, yeah. What is he? 22?
No comment. But it was proof.
Yeah.
That he's younger than me.
Right.
Jeez. I'm embarrassed I even told that story.
Well, me too. I don't wonder. PepsiCo announced on Friday it would no longer use an ingredient in Gatorade after consumers complained. They had this something called brominated vegetable oil, which is used in citrus versions of the sports drink to prevent the flavorings from separating. And it was the object of a petition started by this young girl, Sarah Cavanaugh.
A 15-year-old girl in Mississippi became concerned about this ingredient. She read about it, and the studies that she read about have suggested their possible side effects, including neurological disorders and altered thyroid hormones. You don't want to mess with the hormones. And that's
probably... But here, we can play this. Yeah, so she started,
yeah. Oh, God.
She started this online petition, and Molly Carter, a spokeswoman for Gatorade, said the company had been testing alternatives to the chemical for roughly a year due to customer feedback.
They knew.
So the people empowered have won, and instead of brominated vegetable oil, they're going to use sucrose acetate isobutyrate.
And what's the best part about that, of the sucrose acetate isobutyrate, is that it's an emulsifier that is generally recognized as safe as a food additive by the Food and Drug Administration. It's generally safe.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I think I'd stay away from it.
I don't know. I don't drink a lot of Gatorade, but you always think when you have that, oh, those electrolytes, it's so good for you, you know?
Yeah. Water. All right, let's get back to our phones.
I have my water here, along with my soda.
Okay. Number of people want to talk about women in the military. Here's Darren in Livonia. Darren, you're on the air. You think it's a good idea or a bad idea?
Well, I'm just going off of what my friend said. He was in Afghanistan for a while, and he said it's a bad idea.
How come?
See, finally, that's someone who says it's a bad idea. Why?
Why did he say?
He wasn't able to shower for 6 months at a time.
He wasn't what?
He wasn't able to shower for like 6 months at a time at certain times in his deployment.
Yeah.
And, women have that event every month. And he said, since I can't shower, it would be quite unsanitary after a while. And he said that, by then that the enemy could actually smell the platoon coming. So...
Oh, my God! You did not just say that.
I'm just going by what a retired vet told me.
Oh, my God.
You're the one to say it.
You know those people of other races, they can smell when white women menstruate.
Oh, my God.
All right. We'll think about that one, Darren, but not for very long.
Okay. There's one theory.
Okay. Belle Isle. Belle Isle is a, as it's called, a jewel, a city jewel. And it's been...
I love Belle Isle.
Belle Isle is wonderful. A lot of suburbanites don't like to go there. I go there
the
time. I go
even
there
with the trash.
I go there now less, or I go there less now.
Peter, you and I used to go when we were syndicated nationally. We would sometimes stop there on our way home.
That's right. And I used to love to take my dog there.
Yeah.
Now I got a bitty dog. I wouldn't let her, the new one, loose there.
She's still a Belle Isle puppy. Come on.
Yeah, well. And anyways, but the island needs millions of dollars of improvement and regular maintenance.
Well, the regular maintenance is the biggest part right there.
And the city has no capacity to do it. So they put a committee together of three council people, Kwame Kenyatta and Joanne Watson. Joanne Watson usually is pretty sensible. I don't know much about Kenyatta. And they're vocal opponents of state involvement in Belle Isle. And that council member Kenyatta said, you're going to break the spirit of the people by approving a proposal for their backyard. In other words, for letting the state take over.
There was this amusement park idea, water park idea.
Well,
they're getting a little crazy with it. Can't we just clean it up?
Well, yeah, that's why I think that Kenyatta is really off base to talk about that turning into an amusement park or a water park. For one thing, it's a flyby. for migrating waterfowl. So bird watchers go there to see this incredible array of different waterfowl, ducks, geese,
so let's turn it into a circus.
Yeah. Remember last week we were talking about these billionaires wanted to make it an independent city-state with...
I know.
Yeah, yeah. Leave Belle Isle alone. In fact, where was it? Oh, yeah. It was actually on the Detroit News or Free Press, Detroit News site, where they had a before and after shot. So they had the way, this repair now, and then how they, they kind of with the Photoshop. Proposed. Yeah. So, and one of the, and they're talking about it would make a lot of jobs for, not hundreds or anything, but jobs for Detroiters. But it's really crucial that Detroit proper residents do not have to pay any entrance fee.
Yeah.
And as someone who lives in the suburbs outside of Detroit, I think it'd be perfectly fair to say there'd be a either daily, just like when you go to any state park.
Yeah.
And I have a state park sticker on both my cars, so that wouldn't bother me in the slightest.
Right.
All right, let's continue on. 313-298-WRIF, open lines for you. Here's Mike in Westland. Hey, Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? I got a couple comments. I think it's a horrible idea, women getting into combat roles.
How come?
I was in the Marine Corps, and, you know, especially in the Marine Corps, the Marines have such a tight brotherhood, it's second to none. And when you throw a woman in there in any shape or form, the 22-year-old Marine can become a 22-year-old. And, you know, other things are going to be going through his mind.
Yeah.
Other than the mission.
God, can't you dudes control your penises?
No. No, that's what he's saying. No.
God.
No, they can't.
Come on, get control of yourself.
You know what, Mike, I was reading something. You know, in Israel, they have, which is a pretty tough fighting force, I think they're completely integrated by gender, and I don't think they have the problems. But, that is true. You know, they always talk, what is it, a band of brothers and all that.
Yes,
I mean,
exactly.
Could you have a band of brothers and sisters? I don't know. I've never been there. So.
And I have another comment, too.
Sure.
I tuned in a little bit late, so I didn't hear all the callers. If they're going to allow women into combat roles, are they going to insist that women sign up for the Selective Service also?
Oh, that's interesting.
Because I highly doubt Obama would want his two daughters signing up for the draft.
Yeah, well, usually the people at the top don't wind up sending too many of their kids into combat. Sometimes.
Yeah.
But you know what? That's very interesting. Right now, I forgot about that. There's, there's not a draft, but every male's 18th birthday, they have to register with the Selective Service. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is very interesting.
Good question.
Mike. That is a good question.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Yeah. Now you boys control yourselves out there.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, like I say, they've been pointing to Israel as an armed force that has gender integration without any real problems. I mean, we know that there are problems in the military as it is with sexual assault,
right.
and the military's been trying to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's tough. I mean, if you can imagine how band of brothers and whatever, what a stressful situation it is. And there is, I was joking about testosterone poisoning, but there's a lot of testosterone flowing. There must be some sense that, or maybe even a great sense that any minute it could be your last, right?
Yeah.
You're riding along. I mean, it's not like
you're
facing a huge army, but, all these roadside bombs and what have you. So I don't know.
I don't either.
I don't know. I'm just what I said earlier. I think right now we're headed towards equality in all aspects of life, and that's what it was. What they call the democratic revolutions, of which Britain and France and the United States and other countries were all part of, began on a fairly limited basis of equality, although, and the most pronounced, by the way, was it France or the United States? Let's give it to the United States, our country, because it was codified about equality. And then certainly by 1866, where I think it's the 14th Amendment that talks about equal protection under the law, even though that was not meant, even though that, segregation began in full force after 1877, even though women couldn't vote, trying to think of all the other, you know, discriminatory things, certainly employment for women, the oppression of gays, all that stuff, that all occurred. But the model was, the idea was that of equality. No one said there should be, there's nowhere in a constitution that allows for men to have it over women, or whites to have it over people of color, or, you know, straight people to have it over gays or anything like that. It says all men are created equal, and there's equal protection under the law. So no way. I'll bet you at least a couple of these conservative judges vote to throw out the Defense of Marriage Act.
Right, which a lot of people may not know. That's to protect marriage between a man and a woman.
Yeah, because it's, you know, under, you know, great assault, because of the homosexual agenda.
Right. Right, I mean, you know.
Yeah, but
they're going to ruin straight marriage completely. Yeah. It's already ruined,
yeah, because
in my opinion. 52% of marriages end up in divorce.
Is it that much?
Yeah.
Wow.
I've done it twice. I've contributed to those numbers.
Oh yeah, I was saying about these criminal corporations. 90% of the corporations that were criminally convicted between 1989 and 2000—that's 11 years—donated overwhelmingly to which political party? The Republicans.
What a shocker!
A study by the corporate crime reporter Russell McIver, who I've interviewed, found that 10 out of the current top 100 donors to the 2012 political campaign have pled guilty to crimes. The criminal convictions file that was considered in the study included convictions during the 10 years between 89 and 2000. An examination of that list by the present reporter, what does that mean, indicates that 9 of these 10 big donating criminal firms gave far more to Republican political campaigns than Democratic ones. Only one firm, Pfizer, donated more to Democrats, and they contributed only slightly more to Democrats than to Republicans. By contrast, each one of the 9 big donating Republican criminal corporations, these are ones that have all been cited for criminal activity, not for misfeasance, but for malfeasance, that they were actually committing criminal acts. And when these corporations are convicted of these criminal acts, it's not like anybody goes to jail. They've got to pay, like they say, the largest, you know, civil fine and, you know, and this, and they wind up paying $120 million, which is, you know, less than they pay their CEO.
Right.
And they just, you know, take it off of their, you know, taxes. But anyways, each of the 9 big donating Republican criminal corporations, Honeywell, Lockheed, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Boeing, GE, Northrop, Koch Industries, Raytheon, and Exxon. Get that. Honeywell. And that's all military industrial complex. Same with Lockheed. Same with Boeing. Same with GE. Same with Northrop. Same with Raytheon.
Hey, right. War is great for these corporations.
Yeah. And Exxon.
And that's why they happen.
And Exxon. Biggest corporate profits in world history. At the same time, they are
destroying the planet.
Thank you. Donated far more to the Republicans than the Democrats. And the most lopsidedly political criminal firm of them all, the Koch Industries, which organized the Tea Party starting when Obama first entered the White House, donated a whopping 98% to the Republicans. Yeah.
To the tea baggers.
Yeah. So this this concentration of money is it distorts democracy, first off. And if those of you who follow politics quite a bit, which I don't think is everybody, I mean, who has a taste for it? I mean, it's a dirty job.
It really is.
We have to get paid to do this. But there was this Supreme Court decision called Citizens United, which said that money is speech, so that corporations, for instance, could give as much money as they wanted, much of it
unrestricted.
Unrestricted, yeah. And unaccountable. So there's these campaigns going on right now to deny former Republican Senator Chuck Hagel the Secretary of State position. Because, I don't know what they say. You know, they say a lot of things about him. But there's millions of dollars being spent on anti-Chuck Hagel ads, and you can't even tell who's putting it out. So it's secret speech. It's kind of like, you know, talking behind your back, except, well, it's like screaming behind your back because it's so much money.
Yeah.
But the profits, according to this article, let's see, where is this all coming from? This is a report, by the World Economic Forum, that that's in Davos, which is
Switzerland.
In Switzerland, where they all the
which is where Tina Turner is now giving up her U.S. citizenship and becoming a full-fledged Swiss.
I thought she would go back to Nutbush City.
Nope, yeah. I don't think so.
You know the Bob Seger song Nutbush City?
Yeah,
that is was actually written by Tina Turner.
I did not know that.
I just learned this recently. And Nutbush City is an actual city in Tennessee where Tina Turner came from. What's her name? What was her original name?
It was Anna Mae Bullock.
Anna Mae Bullock.
Yeah, she lives in a picturesque town of Kuznacht on the shores of Lake Zurich. Doesn't that sound lovely?
Yeah.
Oh, she's been over there since 1995 when her longtime partner, German record executive Erwin Bach, was transferred there.
When did she leave Ike?
Long, long time
ago.
Who
was a son of a bitch? They used to beat the crap out of her.
Yeah, that was awful.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Anyways, the profits of the world's 100 most wealthy individuals last year would be enough to wipe out world poverty, according to this. And not just once over, but twice over. But the vast amount of money that has flowed to the top of the world's financial food chain would be enough to eradicate the worst kind of poverty a full four times over. Mm. So this greed where wealth concentrates at the top isn't a matter of it's just their money. I mean, it is, because the legal system of the world allows people to maintain this extravagant wealth way beyond which they could use to consume anything. And in some ways just exists as a trophy, while people perhaps even within eyesight of the huge towers that they're ensconced in are living in abject poverty, particularly in other countries.
Right. Yeah, with third world conditions where there's no running water or fresh water, no electricity, and it goes and they're starving.
Such an explosion in extreme wealth and income inequality represented by these numbers is exacerbating and hindering the world's ability to tackle poverty, warns international aid group Oxfam International in a new analysis published ahead. Oh, no, it wasn't published by the World Economic Forum. It was published by Oxfam. And what are these commies doing? Oh, yeah, they're trying to feed people, right?
Yeah. Dare they?
Yeah. According to the report, the cost of inequality, how wealth and income extremes hurt us all, the 240 billion net income in 2012 of the richest 100 billionaires would be enough to eliminate extreme poverty four times over. In releasing the report, Oxfam is calling on world leaders to curb today's income extremes and commit to bringing back inequality levels to at least those experienced in the early 1990s. You want better inequality, but I suppose, what the hell? And here's what they suggest: a reversal of the trend towards more regressive forms of taxation. In other words, progressive taxes means that the more you make, the larger your tax burden becomes, because it used to be under that well-known communist dictator Dwight Eisenhower, the Republican president during the 1950s here in the U.S., the marginal tax rate was 90%. That means, once you get over a certain level, I don't know what it was, like $5 million or something like that, then every dollar you made over that was taxed at 90%.
Amazing.
And you know what? Things worked pretty well. The rich were rich.
How did they feel about that?
There was a middle class. And then both,
it was just the way it was, right?
Democrats and Republicans began just unraveling it to now Obama is called a socialist because he wants to return the marginal tax rates for the ultra wealthy to what they were under Clinton.
And it's not like he wants to go back to the 90% anything, people.
All right.
Get crazy.
So also, Oxfam suggests a global minimum corporation tax rate, measures to boost wages compared with returns available to capital. In other words, why do corporations export jobs? Why did Romney and others want these jobs to go overseas? Because they could pay people, instead of $20 an hour, they could pay them $20 a week.
Yeah.
Just a fee. People said, well, hey, that makes sense.
And not blink an eye.
Yeah, but it makes sense, right? I mean, you want to get things as cheap as possible, and if you get labor cheap, why not do it? Well, I guess it means, do you have a conscience? Do you have compassion?
And then they bitch about lack of jobs in this country.
Yeah.
The Republicans.
Right.
Well, the jobs numbers aren't looking any better. That's because you jerk-offs sent them all overseas.
The rich jerk-offs. Yeah.
Yeah.
The group says that the world's richest 1% have seen their income increase by 60% in the last 20 years, with the latest world financial crisis only serving to hasten rather than hinder the process. Now, think about that. You or someone you know, or at least if you don't know anybody, at least you've read about what people are suffering. I just, the two people I know, one's a tradesman, mm-hmm. and the other, and a woman works in the health services,
mm-hmm.
and they were, and these people are, I guess, they're over 40. It makes them middle age, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They now have no health insurance whatsoever. That at
I
her,
know so many people.
At her job, it. At her job, they want her to pay $400 a month.
Oh my God.
For her health care.
That's.
And these and this health and you know this isn't a small place. Virtually no one has taken this because
really?
they can't afford it.
Well, yeah. First, you have to have the money.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see. Ben Phillips, a campaign director at Oxfam, said, "We sometimes talk about the have-nots and the haves. Well, we're talking about the have-lots." We're an anti-poverty agency. We focus on poverty. We work with the poorest people around the world. You don't normally hear us talking about wealth, but it's gotten so out of control between rich and poor that one of the obstacles to solving extreme poverty is now extreme wealth. Well, of course it is. I mean, it's a pie. I mean, if there's $100 and one guy has nine, say there's 100 of us and there's $100 and there's all sorts of ways we could split it up. You know, communism would be everybody would have a dollar, right? We'd split it equally.
Right, right.
But the other extreme wealth capitalism, you have one guy has $9, and then the other 99 people split the dollar that's left.
Yep.
Yeah. And the idea, this whole thing is, well, it's their money and they earned it. I actually sometimes don't even know how to refute that. I suppose it's a matter of values. And if you're willing to defend, and if when I say you don't have much money at all. You certainly don't, no matter how much money you have listening to the show, you have nothing compared to the richest rich people that we're talking about here. But the majority of people that are listening to the show, I'm sure, are of moderate means. And to defend that these people that have wealth that they don't need, can't use to the detriment of literally millions of other people, I can't imagine what kind of value system you have.
You're right.
To be quite blunt about
weak.
It.
A weak
yeah.
one.
Yeah.
And what about your heart?
Yeah.
What about heart?
You got to have heart.
That's right.
Here's Todd in Madison Heights. Todd Heights, Peter and Jeline, you're on the air. Welcome.
Love the show, you two.
Thank
I've been listening
you.
For a while.
All right. Welcome.
I've got a comment about health care.
Sure.
Our governor is messing with our health care here in Michigan.
How's he doing it?
I know he wants to change Blue Cross from a non-profit and give policies to the policy holders.
Okay. You know, I did see something about it. Sometimes I have to say... I see that kind of stuff and my brain kind of fuzzes over. But that's the problem. A lot of this stuff is happening and, you know, it's not like big historic events happen, you know, like the Iraq War and 9/11 and, I don't know, what else and, the wars and,
mm-hmm.
and, huge strikes and stuff like that. But some of this
big
stuff.
Big shootings, mass shootings.
Well, you know, I was thinking about big historic things that happened. But what Todd is talking about and some of the other things that we talked about, the way that the Republicans are trying to erode democracy, is really beneath the radar. And when I think, geez, I'm supposed to know all this stuff and I don't even know it's really going on sub rosa, isn't it, Todd?
Yes, it's really shameful what the Republicans have done to this country as of lately.
Yeah, and in Michigan, that lame duck session wasn't so lame for them. They got all kinds of crazy things
about 300 things through, and so well. And I would suspect after this great outpouring of support. I'm going to put it another way. This great denial of conservatism that occurred in November, that that probably a lot of the liberal voters, the Democratic Party base, are just going to go back to sleep and think, okay, we're going to let Barack take care of it. But believe it, the Republicans are going to be thinking they're going to do another 2010, where vast numbers of Democratic Party voters just stayed home because they yawn, you know, they don't even know, people don't even know who the congressional representatives are and what have you.
Disengaged.
Yeah.
And Barack Obama, I'm trying to find that article right now.
Thank you, Todd. I appreciate your comments. Thanks for telling us about it. I'll go home and read about it, I promise.
He's Obama the organizer helped me win second term fights. He's really pushing for this, for what's going on in the second term, and he's also talking about this next election in the next couple of years.
Well, are the Democrats finally figuring it out that if they don't start organizing right now for the 2014 elections, it's going to wind up just the same thing that happened? You know, the Boner keeps talking about that America speaks through the House of Representatives, that the majority of people, both in 2000, in 2008, but in 2010 and in 2012, that the Republicans had a majority in the House. And this is really the people's House. This isn't the elite Senate.
Yeah.
This is, you know, down in the... But, as I've said a couple of times tonight, the Republicans lost the popular vote overall for the House by 1.5 million. But the districts were engineered to give the Republicans...
I mean, that's bigger than anyone can imagine.
Yeah,
really.
So, and between that and voter suppression and numerous other things,
yeah,
this is the way our democracy is going to be altered worse than ever. And that in the insertion of big money to completely control
right.
elections.
And people got lazy, I think, the voting population. You know, it wasn't a presidential year, so they're thinking, well, it's not as important. Well, that got us in trouble.
When the Boner talking about the people have spoken, I forgot what the fall off was in the voter participation, but it was tremendous.
All right, it was.
Let's take a little break. Hey, we want to hear from you, and we got one segment left. A lot of subjects we brought up, but we'll revisit them when we come back. But join us, and here is the number.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Clipping coupons. Standing in line at 4 a.m. Buying five to get one free. Maybe it's me, but I don't think it should be that hard to save money. Which is why we made Geico.com so easy. Just a few clicks and you could be saving hundreds of dollars on your car insurance. And when you switch to Geico, you can do practically everything online. Report a claim, update your policy, even pay your bill. Click, bam, boom. Visit Geico.com today. Click, bam, boom. I'm rather fond of that one.
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much. Welcome back to our final segment. I want to get some of you that are waiting online. We've been talking about women in combat, whether it's a good idea or a bad idea.
Majority of people saying that they think it's fine, but we did have a couple of, one really bizarre phone call.
Said because
of women menstruating, it's going to attract.
What is Alice Cooper saying? Only women bleed.
Oh, my God.
Real quickly, David's listening in Walla Walla, Washington, because this is an international show. We're heard all over the world. Hi, Peter and Jolene. Good to hear you too tonight. As for women in frontline combat positions, all I can think to say about that is what my old buds from NAM used to say, and that is, let them bleed just like the rest of us. Finally, as for myself, all I can think about girls.
And he doesn't mean what the other caller said.
Yeah, as for myself, all I can think about girls equally eating lead is that they must have truly lost their minds.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, right. Here is Rick. Rick is in Farmington Hills. Rick, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing tonight?
We're good.
I think it would be a good thing.
How come?
You know, Israel, when their kids get out of, I think it's junior high school, everybody goes in. And like you said, they fight. They don't be playing around. So if a woman in the United States wants to get in the armed forces, then come on.
Yeah.
Join the party and stuff, because, you know, it might be a stepping up for equality, you know, the equality thing.
Sure.
Women are below what men get paid. But, hey, she has a right to fight for her country just like a man does. And if you can fight with some girls out there, can't thump and throw down, let them come on.
Like, more power to them, right?
Yeah.
Why not?
Rick, I got an email from Terry, who writes in the call talk, yes@yahoo.com. Women in some communist countries fought alongside their male comrades during World War II. So they're
the resistance, the underground. There was women fighting.
Yeah, they did.
And besides, a man needs a good woman to stand back to back and toe to toe. So let's get busy.
All right. You have a good evening.
Okay, you too, Doc.
All right. Okay. I'm not sure what that meant.
I know.
Let's see. I thought we had. Oh, yeah. I don't. No, that's not the one. Yeah, here is one. I don't. You know, we talked a little about the Confederate flag and what that represented.
A little. We talk about it a lot because it's a vile piece of fabric and symbolism.
Well, it's the flag of the greatest traitors to the United States that ever was. And what I said, I couldn't understand how anyone could fly a Confederate flag and then pledge allegiance to the flag of the U.S. because. Yeah. Contained in the pledge is one nation, indivisible, and Confederate flag is the sign of tried to divide this country. But I don't know what to make of this. Someone sent me this. It said, my Confederate flag will not come down. And the shot is a young African-American man standing in front of a Confederate flag. And I don't know whether this is him or not, but he says, my college wants me to remove my Confederate flag from my window. It will not go down without a fight. It's my American right to view any symbol how I want to view it. If I'm not a racist, then my Confederate flag isn't racist. Kill people with kindness, and may God bless America. I don't know what to make of that.
I don't know what to think of it either.
You know, on one level, sure, I think you got a right. You can fly a Nazi flag. You can fly a communist flag. But what I was talking about was that there's got to be some disconnect there. I mean, how can you be a patriot, an American patriot, and fly the most anti-patriotic flag that existed in our history? So I don't understand that.
I don't get it.
Yeah.
That one threw me, too.
Here is Adam in Windsor. Adam, thanks for making our show international. Hi, you're on the air.
Click it, Peter.
Oh, yeah. I didn't do it. I'm sorry. Adam. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
We're good.
Hi.
Big fan. I'm in the Canadian military, two tours over in Afghanistan. If you guys are looking for some examples on how women function, you know, on the front lines, you go always just look north to us. You know, we've had women on the front lines, geez, in every squadron I've been in.
This is in
Canada.
The Canadian Army.
Yeah, of course. We haven't had any major issues. You know, I've
on both deployments, I worked with females. And,
really?
Yeah,
they weren't in combat, though, or were they?
Yeah, combat. Well, fighting squadrons.
Yeah. Hey,
we have females in our special forces as well.
If I say something to you, don't get mad at me, okay? I want to say something.
Yeah, no problem.
On the show before, I've said that Canada ought to disband its military. yeah.
Listen, everybody's entitled to their own opinion.
I know. But here's
Canadians
why.
Are so damn polite.
Yeah, they are.
He's
but
being nice to you,
but here's
Peter.
Why. Here's why. Is that countries generally need armies in order to fight a war. And there's only one country that is ever going to invade Canada, and you're talking to a couple people that are sitting in that country right now. The United States has contingency plans, like it does for every other country in the world, to invade and occupy Mexico, Canada, Europe, China, Asia, everything. They've got this all down, so in case something happens. Canada could save hundreds of billions of dollars by not having an army. And that money could all go to, social services and the medical programs and all of that. And if anybody, I don't know who, China or Russia decided to invade Canada for some odd reason, the United States would have your back. So why have a military?
Well, of course, you guys would have an obligation to help us, just like we had an obligation to help you guys after 9/11. That's the entire reason we went to Afghanistan with you guys.
Well,
but
not that it's unappreciated, but I'm saying if you didn't have, there's a couple of countries that don't have armies, like Costa Rica, mm-hmm. I think, they get along fine without one.
But you're forgetting that Canada's always trying to be one of the big boys with you guys.
Well, there's a cost to that as well, right?
There is. Yeah. We've always prided ourselves on our military heritage and on how we'd like to assist you guys as much as possible and assist the world, basically.
Yeah. All right. Good answer. Thank you, Adam.
Thanks, Adam.
Appreciate it. Yeah, we didn't even think about that one.
No.
That there was a Canadian has that. There's been a, Obamacare. Oh, by the way, I was talking earlier, those people I knew that didn't have health insurance,
yeah.
They're just hoping for 2014, next
Peter,
year.
You're looking at someone without health insurance. Remember that?
You still don't have health insurance?
No. I'm waiting for 2014, too.
Do you know, and here's another
thing. Did
story.
I say 2014? 2014.
Yeah, that's a long way. What exactly is going to happen? Do you understand that completely?
I'm just...
same with them. They're just hoping.
Yeah.
Well, a flood of lawsuits from Roman Catholics, Evangelicals, and Mennonites are challenging a provision in the new healthcare law that requires employers to cover birth control in employee health plans. And they considered a clash between religious freedom and health care access that may wind up in the Supreme Court.
Now, am I wrong? Is Viagra covered? It's covered for men, isn't it? I do believe it is.
But not birth control. But I'm not quite sure.
Does anybody know that? I'm pretty sure that's the way it is.
Do you realize that everything we talk about health care, I say I don't know?
Well, Peter, who really does?
But
do you even think that the people, men and women in Congress, even know what the hell's going on with it?
Probably not.
I think it's all so new.
But there's been dozens of federal lawsuits, not only by religious institutions like Catholic dioceses, but also by private employers ranging from pizza mogul to produce transporters who say the government is forcing them to violate core tenets of their faith.
That's that Domino's freak.
Yeah, now... So just because they have a particular view, they're going to deny their employees. Yeah.
This guy is that. What's his name? Monahan.
Yeah.
Yeah. I quit eating, and I like myself a good pizza pie.
Me too.
But I quit eating Domino's pizza so many years ago because of his anti-abortion stance, his big, giant, stupid cross that he has over there. I'm not disparaging religion. I'm just saying this guy has to go over the top with everything.
Once put everything in your face.
Yes, that's my point. Just go to church, pray, and come on out like everybody else. But I quit eating it. And I remember, this is a quick story.
Sorry.
When I was married, it was banned in my household. Banned. No Domino's pizza. I went out of town. I think I went to like Puerto Rico or something. When you live in Miami, you go out of town to Puerto Rico and things like that. I came home and I found Domino's pizza boxes in my house and I went crazy. And
oh, no.
I thought, my God, am I being a little bit too demanding with this guy?
No. Don't think that.
And now, we're divorced and we're friends, but he's become as political.
Is that right?
If not, there's no way he can be more than me, but he's getting there.
Connect this up with the fact that 3 days after the 40th anniversary of the decision in Roe v. Wade that legalized abortion, that said it was a matter of privacy, that the reproductive rights were a matter between a woman and her doctor, not between a woman and
the government.
Thousands of right-wing male legislators,
mm-hmm.
that, as usual, tens of thousands of abortion opponents from around the country protested on Friday at the National Mall for the annual March for Life rally. Now, do they get this at all? On one hand, they want to deny employees birth control,
mm-hmm.
that would stop,
right. Yeah, that would prevent pregnancies,
and
but then they want to prevent
abortion.
Yeah,
yeah.
These people.
Let's see. Okay,
and that old Rick Santorum was there too.
Yep. Tim from Farmington says Viagra and Cialis is not covered by Blue Cross.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I thought I'd heard it was. Well, that's Blue Cross. Maybe.
Yeah. Here's Charlie in Canton. Charlie, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, no problem.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, earlier when you were talking about women in the military, my friend Darren called in talking about his buddy, and I was the friend that I told him that stuff.
Oh, about the...
Yeah, but there's more to it. He just didn't say it. Yeah. I served with the 173rd Airborne in Afghanistan as an infantryman.
Okay.
And women, period, are just a distraction. And there's going to be one guy that's going to
want... Wait.
Did you say women's period or women, period?
Women, period, are a distraction, whether they're on it or not.
Yeah. Well, I agree.
Peter!
There's going to be one guy that's going to want to have sex with her. And when I was over there, a lot of girls were getting pregnant.
Huh.
You don't get no birth control in Afghanistan.
Well, I wonder how...
Well, that's stupid, too.
Well, of course it is, but...
I mean, I feel like what you're saying is women are, like, second-class citizens in the military. Is that true?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
Well, that sounds like it.
Well, women, you don't usually think of women as fighting. You think of men as fighting, right?
I don't know. It just seems like women are just an object for sexual pleasure.
Well, you know, somebody made the point when you're in your 20s and... guys, you know, when they're 70.
You know what? Men, I don't care what age they are. They're that horny.
They're distracted.
That's the way it is. They're distracted every day. You guys somehow control yourselves as you go throughout your day.
What, Charlie?
I don't know too many women that can carry a 130-pound rucksack on their back plus the body armor.
I know a bunch of women who can.
Well,
I could never. No way in hell.
Well, that's it. And there's probably any number of guys that can't as well. So maybe when it comes to that standard, it ought to be that if you can do it, you can do it, no matter what your gender
you
is.
You have to pass a physical test.
I don't know. Well, here's the deal, Charlie. There's other armies. We got somebody from Canada. I think it was Adam.
Women are just a distraction, period.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I can't get over it.
I find that to be the case.
Peter.
What? All right, Charlie, thank you very
much.
Come
on.
What?
You guys need to think your head that's up here once in a while.
Yeah.
am I distracting you?
Yeah, a little. I don't want to, I don't want to make any public confessions. But it's easy for guys to get distracted.
I know.
Yeah.
I've been on this planet for a while.
Yeah. Hey, you know, one of the things that happened, that these... men, some women, but these men get pretty nutty about abortion.
Yes.
There's usually women that are head of these right to life groups, but a lot of the activists.
I've met them. I've seen them.
They get crazed about
it. Well, they're really crazy.
This guy here, what a weird first name. Rives, R-I-V-E-S, Rives Miller Grogan has something to say. The way he says it keeps getting him in trouble at the U.S. Capitol. After the 47-year-old Californian climbed 40 feet up a tree near the Capitol reflecting pool and tried to shout down President Obama's
inauguration address on
Monday, a judge has ordered him to stay away not only from the Capitol building but from the district entirely. Grogan, an anti-abortion activist, eluded capture for 5 hours on Monday. A Capitol policeman said that he annoyed onlookers below by loudly shouting. All right. What about freedom of speech?
Well, he was probably...
He had just been arrested.
He was probably really offensive.
And charged with disorderly conduct last week. He said he shouted from the gallery of the U.S. Senate. He's been convicted five times in the district since 2009.
Police One time said, he was yelling, "Stop killing the babies!"
Yeah. He said he dropped to the ground in the Capitol Rotunda while clutching a doll and screamed in front of 60 visitors. They tried
I have
to,
met this guy when I've been protesting.
You
I
have?
Swear to God I have.
Well, they tried to talk Grogan out of the tree before Monday's ceremony began and then turned to the fire department for a ladder. The fire department's truck couldn't fit through the security barricades, and Grogan climbed higher when police brought in their own ladder. Officials decided to leave Grogan in the tree after the swearing-in to avoid disruptions. Police said he came down on his own after 5 hours. Grogan had a green ticket to the inauguration, which requires him to be screened before entering the area.
Oh, that worked. That worked.
But the real kicker was a judge freed Grogan at a hearing Tuesday and ordered him to return for another February 25th hearing. And Grogan's mother, 69-year-old Penny Grogan of Mansfield, Texas, called her son a wonderful Christian man who has a wife and three children and runs a ministry.
Oh, Texas. Okay, there's a couple of phone calls. Should we try to get them in before the end of the show, Peter?
We can do it. Hi, Night Call, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, I'm Brian from Sunderland. I'm a combat vet.
Yeah.
Hi.
What do you think about women alongside...
Are we just a distraction, period?
I'm an infantry soldier, and I tell you what, women in the barracks is probably the worst idea you can have.
Well, they're not in the same...
Worse than prison. The barracks are worse than prison.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
Yeah, people beat each other up all the time. There's stabbings. It's crazy.
But aren't them women and men separated?
Then well, if they became an infantry unit, they would not be.
Yeah. But, wait, I mean, things are that bad that there's all this violence?
Oh, it's bad.
Huh. Well.
What?
They ought to,
why don't people talk about that
yeah,
more?
Yeah, that's something that ought to be addressed, hey? For sure.
Well, but,
well yeah. You know, I think it's going to be. And oftentimes, you know, when things happen... I mean, for one thing, you know,
worse than prison.
In the
my God,
in the 1940s, the officer corps and much of the army was dominated by Southerners. And when President Truman integrated the armed forces, imagine that having you know they had blacks were separated. You know, people
God.
Said this is you know that the men are never going to tolerate the you know equal quarters with black men and. And what have you. And then, you know, now it's just thought of in the
Everyone's
officer
together.
Corps, chiefs of staff, our generals of the army and all that. So a lot of times it's tough at the beginning and because people aren't used to it, but
yeah.
They begin to accommodate. But you couldn't, I don't know, you know, we, as Mom used to say, we shall see what we shall see. Right. Here's Lisa in Sterling Heights.
Hey.
Lisa, hi, you're on the air.
Click it, Peter.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't want it. Hi. Hi, Lisa, you're on the air. Sorry.
Hi. Actually, I'm in Dearborn Heights. But anyways,
okay.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I just have a quick comment about birth control and these religious people that have a problem with it being covered by insurance. Nobody's forcing them to accept the birth control if it does come covered by insurance. They're really going to tie up time in the Supreme Court because they feel it's against their religious belief. Don't accept it. Don't take it. You know, I mean, what's the big deal?
It's well, just like if you're against abortion, don't have one.
Well, here,
yeah, it's pretty simple.
Thank well, you.
Actually, I don't think those are completely equivalent. I know what you're saying, but here, Lisa, what they're saying is that I am religiously opposed to birth control. I mean, this, and hence, I don't want to be forced to pay for the birth control of people who my employees who want it. I mean, what if they didn't believe in you know,
they're going to take a lot more time off for maternity leave.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know where the modern Christian Science religion is, but they used to not want medical intervention, modern medical intervention. So you could have somebody saying, "Hey, I don't think there should be breast cancer screening or prostate screening or operations or what have you." So when you know, again, I've on one level, I feel. Sort of bad, a little, are you qualified enough, for you know, people that are put in a position of doing things they don't want to do. But at some point, yeah, you know, society comes to a conclusion or a decision about how people are going to be treated and what's available. You know, they just got to kind of suck it up, I'd say. Hey, yeah, and you're right, Lisa, they're going to bother us all with these endless lawsuits.
Yeah, there's 7 billion people in the world.
Yeah, that's enough.
Really? I mean, how are you going to feed them and clothe them? You know, somebody should take some kind of control over something. If it's birth control, well, hey.
You know, I would say it, usually if you had to, most of these people, if you said, which is worse, abortion or birth control, they would, most of them would all would say abortion. Mm-hmm. And they were saying that there was, well, for one thing, as we said earlier, if there was widespread birth control available and easily, that would cut down on the number of the unwanted pregnancies. Mm-hmm. But I noticed in some of the speeches of these anti-abortion people that assembled in Washington, they said there's been 55 million babies, as they call them. They're not babies, but that's what they call them, babies killed. So if they would have had their way, no woman would have had an abortion, and we'd have 55 million more people in the United mm-hmm. States. Elisa, we have to go. We're out of time. Thank you for being our last caller. I appreciate your remarks.
We want to thank Calvin for coming in tonight.
Say, yeah.
Great job, as always.
Yeah, and stay tuned because we've got some good stuff coming up. Yeah, Lawrence Blum's going to talk about high school, race, and America's future. Very important.
Okay.
Jalene?
Peter?
Talk next week.
Yes, now give me a ride home.
Okay.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Ever hear somebody say we can do this the easy way or we can do it the hard way? I mean, what kind of a choice is that? At Geico.com, everything's easy. Easy to see how much you can save on car insurance. Easy to go paperless by automatically paying your bill online. Easy, easy, easy. So visit Geico.com today. Of course, if you prefer the hard way, I guess you'll have to go someplace else. Sorry, I just don't get it.
back.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Oh, who's the star?
Everything that rocks.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You would have thought that the question of race in America would have been settled almost 150 years ago with the defeat of the slaveocracy after the Civil War and the attempts to integrate freed slaves into our society. But we all know our troubled national past and something that remains with us. And to this day, we see virulent racism expressed openly sometimes, and to the point where many of us who consider ourselves anti-racist feel a little hopeless. But then increasingly, we look at the younger generation. These are increasingly our people, young people that aren't caught up in these old stereotypes and these old notions of a time gone by that have hurt us, white people and black people. I mean, black people, of course, hurt the most, but it hurts races, too. It's not a good thing for a country to be at war with itself or to think ill of a sector of the population. And so this was a very heartening book that came across to me. It's called High Schools, Race, and America's Future. And the subtitle is What Students Can Teach Us About Morality, Diversity, and Community. My guest and the author is Lawrence Blum. He's a distinguished professor of liberal arts and education and professor of philosophy at the University of Massachusetts at Boston. And he's written a number of books. One is called I'm Not a Racist, But... And it's the moral quandary of race. And also another one, Friendship, Altruism, and Morality. We're going to talk with him at his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Lawrence Blum, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Very glad to be here, Peter.
You know, you're in the publicity that goes with this. You're defined as a moral philosopher. Give us a little hint into what that would be. What do you treat? And how does that fit into high school's race in America's future?
So my background is in the study of morality, which is a standard field within philosophy. And I taught that subject for many, many years. And then I started getting interested kind of slowly and gradually in racial issues. The course that I taught in the high school that I talk about in the book, High School's Race in America's Future, was constructed as a history course, but with a strong moral component. So I was always putting moral questions to the students, and they were bringing up kind of moral perspectives, which I would kind of affirm the appropriateness of in the class. So it was, I mean, race itself is a very morally charged issue, even though people don't always necessarily think about it that way explicitly. But, you know, there's issues of kind of right and wrong and harm and good and bad that are connected with race. And that's really all it means to look at it from a moral lens.
I know when I was a sophomore in college living in the dormitories at Michigan State University, we'd stay up late debating what is reality. And that is the branch of philosophy. I don't even want to make a fool of myself and say the wrong word, but that would be the branch of philosophy, which would be what? What if we tried to...
That's called metaphysics or ontology, and it's an area of philosophy that I actually don't have any relationship
with. Okay, well, we won't go there. We won't go there with it. But the point being is that how does one find a moral center? Because racists, if you went to the American Nazi Party, they would say they're highly steeped in ethical and moral concerns for, you know, for the race, if you will, for the planet, for the nation. I mean, how does one affirm a morality that, I mean, or is there a universal morality, or is it all just depends on, you know, who's thinking about what?
Well, I think it's something in between. I mean, it's true that Nazis have a moral code, but a lot of moral codes are very screwed up. And I think, you know, most people would be able to recognize that there are people that they know who have views that they think are sort of unfounded in some way. At the same time, there's plenty of room for differing moral opinions. And in the course that I taught, when I would pose moral questions to the students, for example, I asked them whether slave traders, people who, you know, traded in slaves, were doing something that was morally wrong, even though at the time they did it, it was entirely accepted as a,
right.
as a practice that people engaged in. It was a way of making a living.
And it was constitutionally permitted in the original American Constitution.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. So it was permitted, and so people might well have not thought that they were doing anything wrong, but it's a great question to ask high school students whether just because you think you're not doing something wrong, does that mean that you aren't doing something wrong? And just because people around you think that something is all right, does that mean it actually is all right? So the students struggled with that question, and, you know, some of them took a position that's kind of like, well, from our vantage point, we can't really look back 150 or 200 years and say that what they were doing was wrong. We can just say it would be wrong if it was done today. But there were other students who thought, no, morality is more basic than that. And if something is wrong, it was wrong back then, even if people didn't recognize that it was wrong. So that, you know, they would say, well, slavery was always wrong, even though it was practiced by the Greeks. It was practiced for thousands of years without really being questioned. That doesn't make it right. So those were some of the kinds of questions that we were kind of coming to grips with in the class.
Mm-hmm.
And they sort of depended on the idea that, on the one hand, there are some, you can say that some things are right and other things are wrong, but what degree that is kind of a totally timeless truth, that was kind of up for question.
The book is High School's Race and America's Future, What Students Can Teach Us About Morality, Diversity, and Community. It's published by Harvard Education Press. You can go to harvardeducationpress.org. There'll be a link on my website, peterwerby.com as well. And Lawrence Blum was teaching. He's a college professor. He's a distinguished professor of liberal arts and education at the University of Massachusetts in Boston, yet he decided to teach a high school course. How does that come about? I mean, I've never even heard of anyone doing that.
It was a little bit quirky, to be honest, but I was a parent at this high school. My own children had attended it or were attending it at the time, and so I knew some of the teachers there, and just through a set of odd circumstances, I ended up teaching this course, and then they invited me back to teach it three more times. And it was just an incredibly exciting thing to do. It was certainly it's not something I ever expected to do. I don't have any background as a high school teacher, but 17-year-olds, my students were seniors in high school. It was just fascinating to see these students from different racial groups engaging with each other about these racial issues across racial boundaries. I mean, it was really, really fascinating. I felt really almost honored to be able to be in the room with these thoughtful and insightful kids who were, you know, debating the issues of the day and the historical issues that we talked about in the class.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a HBO series called Girls, and everyone's talking about it, so I saw 10 minutes of it, which is the only 10 minutes I'm good to watch, I have to say. But it was a segment where a young white woman was talking to a young black guy, and he said something about being black, and she said, I never even noticed you were black until you brought this up. Does everyone see everyone else through a lens of race, or is the younger generation, in fact, becoming a little more colorblind, or colorblind entirely? Or should I ask the kids?
I think that, you know, I didn't see the show, but I did hear, I heard about the introduction of the black character into this formerly all-white show. I think if somebody says, I didn't notice you're black, that they're saying something that isn't true. They might mean, I did notice that you're black, but it doesn't have the same significance to me that people often attribute to somebody's race. But I don't think they don't notice it. And I do think that the younger generation is more comfortable with racial differences than my generation and perhaps yours as well. But I don't think it's that they don't notice it. I think in a way it's better because they sort of accept racial differences. They realize that they have those differences still make a difference, but the younger people are somewhat more comfortable with those differences. And, you know, what I saw in the class was that they are not only comfortable with them, but they see that there are things to learn about people's different racial backgrounds. And I think many students are actually quite curious about the racial experience of other students, but there isn't a good forum for them normally to really probe those kinds of things. I mean, perhaps they are, as you were suggesting, Peter, maybe they are more comfortable having those conversations with each other, but I certainly had the impression from my class that, you know, even though my students were going to a very racially mixed high school, and they were certainly much more familiar with people of different races than I had been at their age, there were still questions that they had that they, in the normal run of their lives, they weren't really getting to ask one another or to find out about each other.
Lawrence Blum, in your book, High Schools, Race, and America's Future, you're in this high school in Cambridge. Cambridge, probably one of the more favored spots on the planet. It's you know, just in the Northeast, Boston, Cambridge. It's all really, really quite a place to be. And these are kids, and I'm looking at the cover of your book, and they all appear on the face of it, although I could be wrong, all to be middle class. And if so, is that a factor in their attitudes? And if not, maybe explain that.
Well, first of all, the kids on the cover of the book are not the kids in the class.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
Those are models. I had to protect the identity of the kids in the class, so there's nothing that would allow a reader to be able to identify them.
That's interesting. So, okay. Well, the question then, tell us about the school, and certainly middle-class kids in a favored spot on the planet. My family members live very close to Cambridge, so I'm very familiar with the area. Tell us about the class composition as well, social class.
Well, so let me first mention, Peter, that the high school is part of a national network, and I'm sure there are high schools in Michigan who are part of this network. It's called the Minority Student Achievement Network, MSAN. And these are schools that all have a somewhat similar demographic, and so they face similar issues. So there are schools like this kind of all over the country. And they weren't primarily middle-class students. The school has kind of a range. There's a large economic range as well as racial diversity. There's a lot of economic diversity. So yes, I certainly had several middle class students, but I also had many what you would call working class students in the class as well.
And was this an elective class?
Yeah, it was an elective.
So you were, in a way, I'm not trying to find the non-silver lining in this, believe it, but I want to, you know, as much information as possible. These were, of course, were the kids, I mean, I suspect there weren't any racists that signed up for the course.
No, it was a self-selected group, so I assume that nobody who was like a flat-out racist would be likely to take the class. I mean, some of the students in my class thought that by the end of the course that it should actually be a required course for all of their peers when they came in the ninth grade. So if that ever happened, then you would get kids of all kinds of opinions to be in those classes. And, of course, in a way it would be good for students who are carrying a lot of racist baggage to learn something.
These were probably the kids that needed it the least, although I'm sure they benefited from it greatly. I was thinking the ones that didn't elect it that thought, they're the ones that should be in it. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I mean, that's partly true, but the kids came into the class for somewhat different reasons. The class, because I was a college professor, there were some students who took it, not really because of the material of the class, but because it was being taught by a college professor, and it was billed as a class that would give you some sort of taste of what kind of material you would face when you got to college. And I was actually hoping that billing would draw students in who weren't necessarily the highest flying students, who weren't necessarily going to selective colleges, but were more like the students who would come to my university, University of Massachusetts in Boston, and maybe would be the first in their family to go to college. So I actually did have a fair number of students like that who were aiming to go to college, aspiring to go to college, were glad to take a college-like class, but they weren't growing up in a household where they were getting kind of college-like ways of thinking all the time.
I read some of the material that you presented, and you have an article called The Five Things High School Students Should Know About Race, which I think is very interesting and framed in excellent manner. I mean, I have always lived in integrated circumstances, and I've often found that when in the course of some of the political work I've done over the years, is that people that that have come from all-white suburbs, they're always a little surprised or shocked or don't know how to deal with certain aspects of African-American culture that they've been exposed to for the first time. Was this the case here? I mean, because I'm sure I'm just reading these five things high school students should know about race. I know I could learn a considerable amount being in your high school class, but I'm wondering whether these students, whether this was all a big shock. Boy, that's what white people do, or that's what black people do. Was there, or that's what they think? You know, was it a total surprise to the kids?
Well, I think the material in the class was really new to the students. Even though the students had grown up in a city where it wasn't like a white suburban, you might call it a bubble. It wasn't like that. It's a very mixed city. So just on the streets, students have all encountered people of a lot of different racial groups. But the material of the class was really new to most of the students. I taught them about the history of race. And it's kind of interweaving with the history of American slavery going back to the 1600s. And very few of them were aware of that history. They hadn't been aware, for example, that the idea of race itself only came on the scene historically at a certain period of time. Before then, while you had people of different physical types, they weren't understood as different races. So, I mean, I constructed the class so that it would be a really academically serious and challenging course, and I wanted that to be kind of the centerpiece of the course. So while the students might have had experience with kids of different backgrounds, the material they were studying in the class was really new to them.
I have some friends who adopted an African-American child when he was a baby, and he's about 13 now, and every once in a while he says to his dad, "You wouldn't understand, Dad, it's a black thing," and it which totally POs the dad, right? Was there a sense, particularly on the part of the minority students, where they felt that they were misunderstood by the white students and that they had something to tell the white students, whereas the whites, I mean, everybody knows about white culture. It's in your face, you know, 24/7. How did the different racial side, on the cover, which you said aren't the students, there's Asian, African, European faces, so Latin American faces. So.
Well, you can't exactly generalize about the viewpoints of the students in the class. That is, in any of the racial groups, there was kind of a wide divergence of opinions about any question that you brought up. So you couldn't just, I couldn't pinpoint, oh, this was sort of the black view about something and this was the white view. Nevertheless, there were people who talked out of their own experience and said things. So there's one that I can remember in the class, and I talk about this in the book, High School's Race in America's Future, where the students were debating a kind of little moral problem where there was a Latino dance and a white couple was there, and some of the Latino dancers made fun of the white couple and said that they had stiff white hips and couldn't dance very
well. They probably were right, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
And the students chose this incident. You know, it's obviously an extremely minor incident compared to racial incidents in general, but they picked it as something that they wanted to talk about. And a black student in the class said he questioned whether the white couple should be at the dance in the first place, because he said often minority groups have their cultural spaces or their cultural products, and these are often taken over by white people. Now, I'm not sure if he meant, like, taken over economically, like the way, say, hip-hop becomes a huge industry and a lot of white people make a lot of money off of it. Of course, a lot of black people do, too. But in terms of what this student was thinking, I'm not completely sure whether he meant that or whether he meant it on kind of a more local level.
Well, there's what they call cultural appropriation, that it's interjected at the margins of society by Latinos or by African Americans, and then suddenly it's made into a big deal. I mean, in a way, all of rock and roll, you know, white rock and roll is like that, right?
But, exactly so. Yeah. Exactly so. And one year I actually told them about that history so that they would understand that dynamic. You know, and in a way, that's just an understandable dynamic where some groups have power. And as you say, some groups are more marginal, but the marginal groups can sometimes produce things that are of interest to the dominant group. And then it's a kind of mixed thing, because on the one hand, it's kind of good that their products are getting taken up by the majority, but in another way, there's an exploitative dimension to it. But within the class, the fact that this student brought this up, it was just completely off of the way the conversation had been going, and several people jumped on this black student, but it was an insightful point that the student said. I'm not saying ultimately that I totally agree with it, but it was an important perspective to inject into the exchange. Mm-hmm. And it was something that I think a lot of students wouldn't have thought of if this black student hadn't brought it up. So that might be an example of the kind of thing that you are referring to, where there would be a kind of angle on things that would come out of a racial experience that students from other racial groups wouldn't have been aware of before that student said it.
We have just a few minutes left with Lawrence Blum. He is the author of High School's Race in America's Future. It's published by Harvard Education Press. HarvardEducationPress.org is where you can find it, or on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. I don't know if this is asking you to be one of the blind men feeling for the elephant and get a definition of what its character is, but is it possible that we could leave all this racial, I don't know, I was going to say a word begins with a C, racial junk behind it? It is so, it so distorts everything in this country, and I often say in the talk show that I do here in Detroit, if you can't think straight about race, you probably can't think straight about anything else, or you're thinking nutsy about other stuff as well. Are these kids just a sort of a little anomaly in a nice little place like Cambridge, Mass., or are they the hope of the future?
Well, I'm hoping that more people will teach courses like the course that I teach, that I talk about in the book, High School's Race and America's Future. I wrote the book in part to encourage other teachers elsewhere and college professors to see how exciting it can be to teach a course where students are really engaging about race. And you mentioned that other article that I wrote in the Harvard Ed Letter. That's sort of about the civic importance of people coming to grips with race, as your question asked. I think that until we come to grips with race, until we understand race, understand something about its history, and understand how to talk to each other about it, we're never going to be able to get to a positive place about it. So I do see the class as at least an example of a kind of thing that I would hope would happen more often. I mean, maybe it does happen a lot. I'm not a high school teacher, so I can't really say what happens in high schools. Maybe there are courses like this being given in a lot of places. I wouldn't necessarily know whether that was happening.
Would this approach you do in your book, would it work in, because I was thinking the teachers that I know teach in like almost 100% African American schools in Detroit, uh-huh, or suburb of Detroit, and would it work in essentially segregated classrooms of either like all white suburbs or all black districts like Detroit?
I think that like an all-black class or an all-white class would get a tremendous amount out of studying this material. I don't think the experience would be the same as having a mixed class, but I think the material itself is so important and so engaging that students would really be interested in it. And because, you know, just because you have an all same race group, they're still going to have a diversity of opinions. So that, so if you had an all black class, I mean, like my black students who were the single most, there were more black students than any other single group, but they never agreed on the issues. There was a lot of disagreement. So if you had a class of 20 black students, there would be a lot of disagreement about this material. And I think it would be great to teach it in those kinds of settings. Let me just say, though, that one of the points in the book, or something that I hope people would take from the book, is to see why we should actually be trying to create more integrated schools and classrooms, because there are things that can happen in an integrated class that won't happen in an all one race class. So there is, the book is, in part is a kind of argument for integration and wanting to put integration kind of back into the center of educational policy and, you know, housing policy as well.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the broadcast. Lawrence Blum has been my guest. He is a distinguished professor of liberal arts and education and philosophy at the University of Massachusetts. We've reached him at his home, and he's been talking about his brand new book, High School's Race and America's Future, What Students Can Teach Us About Morality, Diversity, and Community. It's available from Harvard Education Press, harvardeducation.org. There'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Lawrence Blum, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. About 50 years ago, a writer named Michael Harrington wrote a book called The Other America, Poverty in the United States. I think it was 1962 in which it appeared. And it was kind of shocking to people because we had lived through this period of great prosperity following World War II, and that the idea that there were still people mired in poverty, not only in big cities, but also in the rural South, the rural Midwest. And there was some attempt during the 1960s, the so-called Great Society programs of Lyndon Johnson, to ameliorate that. But if anything, things have probably gotten a lot worse. In fact, my calculations for what they're worth, it's possible that as many as 40% of the American population live either in poverty or what we call near poverty. That may be a discussion for another time, though. And the ability to chronicle all this is usually done with statistics. But when it comes alive through writing and through photography, I think it has a special quality to it. And joining me now is Dale Maharaj. He has, along with photographer Michael Williamson, written and has a book with photographs in it called Someplace Like America, Tales from the New Great Depression. And Dale Maharaj is an associate professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, and he's published 7 books, including And Their Children After Them, which won a Pulitzer Prize, A Journey to Nowhere, The Saga of the New Underclass. Michael S. Williamson is a photographer at the Washington Post, and this project began, this is absolutely amazing, began like over 30 years ago, where Dale Maharaj and Michael Williamson decided they were going to cover America that's ignored by the mainstream media. By the way, and this is a big, by the way, a big BTW. Bruce Springsteen writes the foreword to this, and he was incredibly moved by Dale Maharaj's book, the one I mentioned last, Journey to Nowhere, The Saga of the New Underclass. And it's a privilege and a pleasure to welcome Dale Maharaj. He's in Northern California right now. That's the place to be. Dale, welcome to the broadcast.
Great to be here. Yeah, but you're talking about Southern California. We up here, we don't like to be compared to those guys down there.
There you go. And I'm sort of stumbling around here because there's so much here, both in terms of material and this lifelong journey with you and your photographer, or actually your partner who takes the photographs, Michael Williamson, in this project. Actually, tell us some about it. I mean, how? I'm looking at a photograph of you guys. What were you, 15 when you began?
Well, we look like we were 15. We met at the newspaper in Sacramento, California, and when you started the show talking about the Other America, I was quite familiar with that book. And what we were finding when we went out, it was during the recession of 1982 in particular, was the other America was expanding into what we used to call the middle class. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, originally. I was a blue-collar kid. I was actually a steel worker myself, briefly, in my youth. And so I understood that world. They weren't just closing down the factories. They were blowing them up. We heard in Youngstown, Ohio, that the big Ohio Works, U.S. Steel, employed thousands and thousands of people. They dynamited the blast furnaces in 1982. So we went there in 1983, and that became the focal point of that first book, The Death of Steel, The Death of Industry, The Loss of High-Paying Jobs Replaced by Walmart Jobs, and what that was doing to people. And, of course, with the end of the 1982 recession, that stuff didn't go away. It's only gotten worse. Now, the economic malaise, and that's a kind way to put it, is spread across a broad spectrum of people. People who live in suburbs are hurting, the way people who were homeless were. They're losing their homes. You go into people's houses, and you see refrigerators with no food because people just can't afford to pay the mortgage, you know, all the gas and for the food.
Well, I was just looking at the New York Times, and for Father's Day, there was an advertisement in the Times for a Patek Philippe, a watch for $38,000. So it's kind of like the Gilded Age. It's not so much like the 1930s. It's almost like the 1890s.
Yeah, the rich have gotten richer, of course. And I think that watch, that's God's way of telling you you're making too much money, man. It's crazy.
Tell us about the book, though, Someplace Like America. So you've been following some of these people for a generation.
Well, actually, one of the families has Michigan ties. Everybody's important, but the biggest part of the book covers this family we met in 1983 when we were in Texas. We were looking for homeless families. We'd heard they existed, and we found this family camping. They'd come down from Michigan. Jim Alexander was in the salt mine in Port Huron. He had a job there. He got laid off. And in those days, there were still oil jobs in Texas. So he took the family, Matthew and Jennifer, age 11 and 12, and his wife Bonnie. They went to Texas, got a job, got an apartment. Life was good, and the economy went bad there. They lost the apartment. He was a Vietnam vet, so going into a tent was a very difficult thing for him.
Sure.
We spent a week with that family, and they had no food, and it was real hard. But they were real strong people, and the kids were doing good in school, even though they were homeless. Flash forward, in 2009, 26 years later, I tracked them down. They'd moved back to Michigan. Jim was living up in Livingston, I believe, in northern Michigan. The kids were in Michigan as well. We had a reunion and learned their story. And, oh, my gosh, what a saga that family went through. They're doing better, nominally. Jim is retired now. Unfortunately, Bonnie had just passed away before we came out. But it's depression, a Great Depression mentality. You know, they don't buy anything on credit. They're very frugal. Matthew had lost his job in 2001 at a plastic extrusions factory somewhere near Detroit, and he ended up joining in the summer of 2001. And, of course, we all know what happened that fall. And now he has a job that's tied to the government, but he has to go do a tour of duty every couple of years for 6 months in Afghanistan or Iraq. He's got four small kids.
Wow. Wow.
So we bring their story forward. It's sort of like you know, this continuation of what this family went through 26 years ago, and we did it with a lot of other characters in the book. We tend to like people we write and photograph about, and we follow them. We become friends with them, and we kind of keep in touch. And so we bring a lot of stories forward. So there's a narration in the book. And I'm hoping there's lessons in these people's lives, and I believe there are strong lessons that we all can learn from, how we can survive these hard times, because they're the true experts. You mentioned, going on the street and talking to real people. I use statistics and figures, but they're secondary to the stories of people like the Alexander family, because, you know, I think, as they say, people can read about this of any income bracket and learn and take away a strong lesson.
You know, there used to be a phrase, one photograph is worth a thousand words. I mean, you literally join the two of them together. I wonder if you think in the digital age that photographs have been devalued some.
Unfortunately, they have. Somebody like Michael Williamson, who still shoots for the Washington Post, goes all over the country. He's sort of like the Bob Dylan of the photography world. He's always on the road, a lot more than I am. His images are poetry. I call him a blues man with a camera.
Huh.
Michael evokes so many things in his images. They're not just pictures. They're not just snapshots. There's a whole lot more to them. And so in the internet, you know, anybody can put up a photo, and we just get blizzarded with these things. But you get a photo like Michael's, and again, because we know these people, and we've spent years and years with them, you know, they know us. They're intimate. They're very intimate photographs.
And you can hold them in your hand. You have the book in your hand. It's not like looking at it at a screen. It has a different quality to it, in my estimation.
Oh, yeah. So I think the image, I'm a strong believer in the image. And Michael and I have done 6 books together now, and on various aspects of this lifelong project of covering workers and people. And I just think my words would be bereft without his photographs. You should see who you're reading about. I really believe that.
Huh. The book is Someplace Like America, Tales from the New Great Depression. My guest is Dale Maharidge. He did the writing and photographs by Michael Williamson, forward by Bruce Springsteen. Bruce Springsteen has a connection that goes right to your book, Journey to Nowhere, The Saga of the New Underclass, right?
Yeah, the book came out in 1985. And it's about a year-long run. We got a lot of attention, you know, good, bad, and ugly. That's how it is with books. You get some bad reviews, you get a lot of good ones. But books always eventually die. They get remaindered. In 1995, I got a call from a woman who said, Bruce Springsteen wants to meet you. And I thought, Michael, or somebody was pulling a joke on me.
Yeah.
And Michael, by chance, was in California doing some work. And so a few days later, we went to the Neil Young's Bridge Benefit in Mountain View, California, met Bruce backstage, and he was inspired to write 2 songs by the book. And so I asked Bruce, I said, how'd you know about our book? He said, I bought it when it came out. He was in the store and picked it up and bought it.
This was the acoustic Ghost of Tom Joad
exactly.
Album?
Exactly. And the song, there's 2 songs. One is called The New Timer, about somebody new on the street. And the second one is called Youngstown.
Oh, yeah, I know that one.
And it's an anthem. I mean, Bruce, in exactly 299 words in that song, captured our entire book, thousands and thousands of words and pictures.
Well, he is amazing.
I always knew Bruce was a great songwriter, but after witnessing how he translated my book into that song, wow. But he sings about the real people, the Marshall family, the man who said them big boys did what Hitler couldn't do.
Huh.
Mr. Marshall actually said something similar to that to me.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And remind people who Tom Joad, J-O-A-D.
Good point. Yes, Tom Joad is the character from The Grapes of Wrath, John Steinbeck, and of course he was, you know, left Oklahoma, came to California looking for work, and had all kinds of horrible things happen to him, just like the people in our book, you know, 50 years later, and so that was a very thematic album Bruce did about workers and real people and their concerns, and you know, Bruce is the real deal. I mean. I meet a lot of celebrities in what I do, and a lot of them are I wouldn't give you a dime for. Bruce is 100% gold. There's no fake in Bruce.
He's an amazing guy, to be sure. His heart is just golden. You know, I've interviewed people that have done books somewhat similar to this. In other words, that they involved photographs of real people, and oftentimes they're about working people. There's a book, I can't think of the name of it offhand, that a woman did a book about waitresses in small towns. And it always seems to me, I mean, as a writer, I also write, I kind of find that easy to do. But saying to somebody, hey, we want to take your photographs, your photograph, because you're poor or you're working class or you're in a Rust Belt town, I don't have it in me to approach anyone like that, number one. And number two, I'm amazed always that people say, hey, sure, take a photograph of me as an example of the downtrodden. Can you speak to that a little?
Well, you know, the thing is, Michael and I, the first thing we do is we listen to people, and we get to know them. Michael doesn't take his camera out sometimes for days. And we don't want anybody who doesn't want to be documented. But having said that, we get to know people, they see where we're coming from. And Michael, you know, has a very hard scrabble background. He had a mother who was a barmaid, traveled all over the country. She had five children by five men. She was killed when he was 11 years old. So he grew up in orphanages and foster homes after that. And I have this blue-collar background. So we're talking to people who we relate to. We have the same backgrounds as a lot of the people we're writing about. And so when people see you're coming from a place of understanding and genuine interest, it's amazing. People almost never say no to the picture by the time Michael gets his camera out.
Huh.
It just becomes a part of it's weird. It's not a friendship. But again, as I say, I love the people in our book. I don't write about anybody I don't like. If I don't like them, I leave. I don't bother.
There's
a lot of genuine concern for the people we're documenting. And I think that breaks down a lot of those barriers.
Yeah, I'd imagine, because, you know, and the other thing is you guys don't show up in a big Buick or anything. And some of this, like on the flap of the dust jacket, there's the photographer Michael Williamson and you, Dale Maharaj, on the grain carver freight train. And for all practical purposes, you look like tramps. Tramps, of course. You know the difference between, what is it, tramps, hobos, and bums?
A tramp and a hobo will work. A bum won't work.
here you go. A tramp is a migratory worker. A hobo is a migratory non-worker. And a bum is a non-migratory non-worker. That's from the 1930s. But
there you go.
But so you guys were on, so you were working. So you what are you doing on the back of, this is 1982, on the back of a freight car?
Well, in those days, a lot of the jobless were riding freight trains, using like buses, free buses, to get from point A, where there was no work, to point B, where they hoped there to be work. So we got on trains. One train we were on had 30 people on it. Darn near all of them were new-time jobless. So that was the way to document the story, not come pull up in the Cadillac in the rail yard when they get off the train and say, excuse me, sir, how was that? We just grab backpacks and off and on over about a three-year period, the biggest period being 4 months, we rode the rails.
You ever get busted by the bulls, as they used to say?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The railroad police, the bull, the bane of all hobos.
Yeah.
It's just like the 30s. They would come in. They would, if the jail wasn't full, I'd be taking you to jail. Sometimes they would take you to jail, but we got lucky and didn't get taken to jail. We learned how to evade the bulls after a couple of years of riding. We became pretty good hobos.
You've seen the film Wild Boys of the Road?
I don't know that one.
Oh, by William Wellman, 1932, about these young boys that when their town goes bust, their dad is out of work, and they start traveling on the road. There's huge battles at these hobo encampments with the police in Cleveland.
Yeah.
All right, but let's not spend too much time on that. Dale Maharaj is my guest. He's done the writing for Someplace Like America, Tales from the New Great Depression, a foreword by Bruce Springsteen. It's published by University of California Press. And if you Google back streets with a plural, the first thing that comes up is a website for all of this. There'll be a link on my site as well, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. On the cover of Someplace Like America, this gets back to the photograph, there's a man, looks like probably in his early 30s, maybe mid-30s, holding a boy, looks about 9 or 10. And it's such a striking photo, and the look in the man's eye, there's pride, there's sadness, even maybe a tad of anger. Tell us about him. Tell us about the photo.
Oh, that's Ken Platt in Youngstown, Ohio. Ken is an amazing human being. We met Ken, and he had red hair. And he was a steel worker, and he was frustrated. He said, you know, what are we becoming? What's going to happen to America? And he saw the future. He said, if we have a future where we have jobs that pay like, you know, Walmart and McDonald's, you're not going to invest in anything. You're not going to buy a house. You're going to buy bread and bologna. So I fell in love with this guy. This guy's great. So I quote him in Journey to Nowhere. And I stayed in touch with Ken over the years. And Ken is one of the rare success stories, people who did better or made it out of the quagmire. He had this thing called a Tandy, a computer, in 1983. He said, I'm messing around with this thing. Long story short, he became this computer expert. He learned how to digitize art, and he got a job at the Butler Art Museum in Youngstown, Ohio. So he went from being a steelworker to a white-collar guy. But when I saw him in 2009, his son was a steelworker. The boy he's holding about to possibly lose his job. They were laying people off at the plant. And then about 2 weeks ago, Michael was in Youngstown, saw Ken, and they just raised his health care through the roof. He says, I can't afford it.
Huh.
What am I going to do? So even though he's working, and this is a story at some place like America, even if you're working, how many people do we know, you know, I know, who have what look like great jobs, have suburban houses, they've had furloughs or rollbacks on their pay? And I don't know about you, but you lose 10% of your income, that'll break you.
That's tough. That's definitely tough. Yeah. Hey, one of the things that I don't think I've made clear, and that's my fault in terms of questioning, in the book, Someplace Like America, there are shots that are 25 years and more apart, right? I mean,
yes.
People that you photographed in the early and wrote about in the early 80s and just recently. Tell us about that a little.
Well, you know, we did these before and afters. We have the Marshall family. The ones who inspired the Bruce Springsteen line about the big boys. We have at a kitchen table the mother, the father, the son, almost 30 years apart. Same thing with the Alexander boy and girl, Matthew and Jennifer. They were holding puppies in the picture in 1983. Michael set them on a stoop and had them do similar body language all those years later. So you can kind of see. And again, what you said earlier about the pictures, you look in people's eyes, there's a lot of truth. In Kent's eyes in the cover, there's a lot of anger, but also pride. In the Marshalls, there's a bit of sadness. And you saw it then, it was more recent, defeated sadness. And what you see in the later pictures is years of defeat. People's eyes don't lie. And in them, to me, is the story of America, what's happened to us. And it's just... I could go on for hours about what I think should be done in America, and I won't, other than to say we have to start thinking about working people again and what they need and not just the hedge fund managers. We become a nation that just cares about what the hedge fund managers do, and of course they pay a lot less taxes percentage-wise than you or me. We got to start reversing that and get back to people. But that's what America is. It's people. We're a country. We're supposed to be a society. I'll stop there.
Okay, well, that's important. I mean, the information is, that we need is explicit. I was going to say implicit. Explicit in some place like America. When it sounds from some of the what you quoted of some of your subjects that they understood the process that's going on, that they have been attacked and defeated. On the other hand, a lot of people think that the fault lies with them, that the old 19th century Horatio Alger myth still is alive, that if I'm in bad economic straits, I've screwed up, I have a personal failing. Other people, look, you can just go to Royal Oak and Grosse Pointe and Birmingham, and you know, the cafes are filled and people are driving bright, shiny cars. I'm poor. Must be my fault. What's the self-image of people? Or it must be a range of it.
Peter, you nailed it. It's either or. People know that they've been downsized because of you know, corporate profits, greed, and all that. To a lot of people, look inward. What did I do wrong? And I really tell them. I said, you know, and after I hear their stories, you know, everybody makes mistakes. But generally, the people that we document, they pretty much have done everything right. I mean, they bought the house, they paid their bills. You know, they didn't overspend their money. But what people are doing, which is interesting, is, and this is kind of like the 30s, but not exactly similar. People are changing their lives. I have middle class people in the book who stopped using credit. They haven't had a credit card in 3 years. They'll never use credit again. They're growing their own food. There's a woman in Muskegon we met in a food line. She and her husband had a business. They lost it. Things went downhill. They separated. They had two kids. She ended up living with her sister with the two kids. We met her in a food line, and she's telling us about how she's gonna, you know, come up from this and you know, grow her own food so they can eat well, save some money, not use credit, and try to instill some new values in her kids. So people are trying to move forward on their own, and this is, at this point in America, this is the best we're going to hope for. And I think in those stories in the book, there are a lot of lessons that we can learn from. And it's got to start changing though on a bigger level. We have to look at those bigger issues eventually.
Sure.
Start that conversation though as soon as we can.
When the people who are the subjects of your writing and of the photographs, when they see this, what's their reaction to it?
I have gotten emails. One thing I do when I do a book like this, I demand the publisher give me extra copies and early, and then I send them Federal Express to everybody in the book. I believe they should see it first before anybody else. And so I did that. I sent out almost 50 books, actually. And I started getting emails and phone calls. There's a single mom in Texas I've known for 10 years. I did a story on her for a magazine back in 2000. And she wrote me, "Thank you for caring about single moms. Thank you for telling our story." That is the best. Forget all the any reviews I get. That's the review I want.
Well,
did I get it right? Did I do it right? Did I do her justice? Does she feel I told her story with dignity?
And for a writer, it doesn't get much better than that, because there is just so much out there that isn't worth the printed word. This really is. The book is Someplace Like America, Tales from the New Great Depression. It's extraordinary books published by the University of California. You can go to Backstreets, plural, Google that, and you'll find a link to it. There'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. The writing is done by Dale Maharaj, and he's been my guest. The photographs by Michael Williamson. The foreword by the great Bruce Springsteen. Dale, thanks so much for being on the broadcast.
It was great to be here, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
My mum always says hard work never hurt anybody. Good advice as usual. So we worked very hard to make Geico.com very easy. Say you want to report a claim and follow its progress. You can do it all online at Geico.com. Not to mention perhaps saving a tidy sum of money on your car insurance. All it takes is a few clicks. So visit Geico.com today. Oh, and Mum, if you're listening, yes, I did wash behind my ears this morning.
of rock. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
fresh right here, right now.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Bingo, that's the one.
Everything that rocks.
My son, I love you, hey.